This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Archie Pitts. Today is 31 May 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on a campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Pitts is kind enough to join us from his home in McKinney, Texas via telephone. Mr. Pitts, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Coleman, Texas, July 31st, 1944.
So you have a birthday coming up before too long.
Yeah, I do.
What were your parents' names?
My parents' name was Archie A. Pitts and Cleo M. Pitts.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do for a living?
Well, my dad started out in the oil field. He was a hard rock miner. He did a little, basically, those two things most of his life. He ended up being a security chief over at the Animax copper mine.
Okay. What about your mother?
Mother was just basically a homemaker. She would take jobs every once in a while. She worked over in one of the public schools for Sarita School District. She worked in the cafeteria for a while.
Mm-hmm.
No, she didn't have any specific career.
Right, right. Now, did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have two brothers. One is 5 years older, and the other is 16 years younger, and I have one sister who's 13 years younger.
Okay, all right. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like to grow up in Coleman, Texas, in that area?
Well, actually, like I said, my dad was in the oil field and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I was born, Dad was over in post-World War II, I guess it was. He was in Manila. Over in the Philippines. And so when he came home after that, I think I was 2 years old, something like that. Anyway, when he came home, he went into the oil field. And oil fields, you were assigned to a rig, and wherever the rig was, that's where we moved to.
Mm-hmm.
So, for probably from that period of time up to about the second grade, we were transient. I didn't grow up in Coleman at all. I grew up mostly in West Texas, eastern New Mexico.
Now, what kind of dynamic did you have there in the family with all of this moving around? What was it like for you?
Well, the best I remember, it had no basic impact on me that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my older brother, he was in school at the time we were moving. I think Mom told me that he went to four separate elementary schools in the first grade.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So moving around quite a bit then.
Yes, what they would do is they would drill for a while, and if they come with a dry hole or whatever, then they would pack up the rig and move it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
At one particular time, we spent 6 months in Louisiana. So.
And that's interesting. Now, how long did this type of moving around last for you?
Well, let's see. I think I was in the second grade. I think. My memory's a little fuzzy. But I believe it was the second grade that Dad stopped in the oil field business, and he went to work for the potash mines in Carlsbad, New Mexico. And that's when we became basically stable. I stayed there until between my junior and senior year in high school.
Okay, so Carlsbad is home to you of some sorts then, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I had most of my formative years there.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting. Tell me about these formative years there, growing up in the Carlsbad area.
It was sort of unique. It was like a high desert, per se. The Carlsbad cabins were closed. I got to see those several times. It was a nondescript childhood, per se. I mean, it was a mining town, and it wasn't anything, like I said, it's nondescript. Nothing stands out to me other than the fact that when I went to high school, I enrolled into ROTC. And I was in ROTC the time I was in the high school until I moved, and I think that's where I got my love for the military. So.
Yeah. Well, tell me about school and growing up. What kind of student were you?
Rotten. Absolutely rotten. I did not apply myself. I did not in the least.
Yeah.
You know. So I was at the bottom of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Interesting. Were you involved in any sort of activities, whether hunting or fishing or sports or anything like that?
Well, a bunch of us guys would get get together and we'd go out hunting jackrabbits and stuff like this out there in the area around Carlstadt, you know. And we also had a spelunking club, and we'd go out and explore caves and caverns and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. Hmm. What led you to ROTC there?
Well, my older brother was in ROTC, and he spoke highly of it. And so when I came in, I could go to ROTC, or I could go to have physical PE, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, let's let me try ROTC. So I tried it for a year, and I enjoyed it.
Hmm.
So I stayed with it.
Yeah. Did your brother go ahead and join the military after this?
Yes, he did. He joined the Air Force when he got out
mm-hmm.
of high school.
Yeah. Did you graduate from high school at Carlsbad?
No, I didn't.
Didn't.
I moved. We moved from Carlsbad to a horrendous culture shock. Moved to Los Angeles, California.
Wow, that is quite a culture shock.
Yeah, I graduated from Reseda High School there. Reseda's out in San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they graduate two classes a year. And my class had 550 in it. They graduated. And that was more than it was in the high school in Carlsbad.
How did you adjust to this new life in that part of the country?
Well, I didn't adjust too well, evidently, because I can't remember having any friends, as it were, you know, when I was there.
Yeah.
In fact, when I showed up, I already had enough credits coming from New Mexico, from Carlsbad, to graduate. I already had enough graduation credits for the high school. I said, well, just give me my diploma and I'll run off and leave. And they said, no, they said, you have to complete senior English. So I stayed taking a course on two semesters just to finish. So
it was just one course for two semesters?
Yep.
Huh, that gives you a lot of free time, I guess.
Yeah, I took an extra course the first semester. I took physiology, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I just took what I had to. I think the two courses. And the last semester, I just took one. So then I started going and doing odd jobs and stuff like this. I'm off to.
Yeah. Now, did you maintain your involvement with ROTC at Reseda, or was it not available?
It was not available.
Yeah. Disappointing for you?
Yeah, to some degree. I enjoyed it. And the last year, if I'd have stayed there, I'd been promoted to the battalion executive officer, you know, and so I'd made it all the way up to battalion staff, and I would look forward to serving my final year there, but things happen and life goes on, so
right.
No big thing.
When did you graduate from high school officially?
62.
In 1962. Okay, now, so it seems that being active in the ROTC was something obviously that appealed to you. Did you consider the military as a career, or at least a possible career?
No, not really as a career per se, but I did have to consider because we had that active draft at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were going to go in, chances are, one way or the other. You could join or you could get drafted, but you were going to go. So I was looking at that. You know, I knew I'd have to serve somewhere at some time in some branch.
Mm-hmm. So you volunteered for the Army then?
Yes, I did.
And when did you enter the Army?
When did I do what? I'm sorry.
When did you enter the Army?
18 May 1964.
In 1964. Okay, so you're looking at about 20 years old at the time, I guess.
I was 19. I turned 20. Excuse me. After basic training.
Mm-hmm. Where did you take basic training?
Fort Ord, California.
In Fort Ord. Tell me what it was like to go through basic training in the U.S. Army in 1964. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I have to preface this, and I'm going to get. I guess people went through basic training. I really didn't. Okay, and let me tell you why.
Okay.
It's funny. When I got to basic training, we got outfitted and everything else, but then we moved over to our company. It was Charlie Company something. And so when I got there, they formed us up by alphabetical order and all the rest of stuff, broke us into platoons. And so this platoon sergeant came out, E7, sergeant first class, he came out and he started calling off names. And the first name he called off was mine. And I said, Lord help, I just got here. I can't be in trouble yet, you know. So, but anyway, so we get up there, and he comes over to me, and he says, I see here that you were in ROTC. I said, yes, sergeant. And he said, do you think you could march this band of idiots into the barracks? I said, yes, sergeant. He said, good. He said, you're acting platoon sergeant.
Huh.
After that, I had my own room. I didn't sleep in the bays. When the guys were doing, like, the machine gun stuff, crawling through mud,
mm-hmm.
you know, that typical scenario.
Right.
And which we did. The platoon sergeant and I was sitting up on the side of a hill smoking a cigarette. So I didn't go through basic training, per se. That's what I had it made.
That's really funny, huh? Right place.
I had it made. I didn't. I did participate in most of the other stuff, but when it got down to the grungy junk and stuff, I didn't. So.
Well, ROTC certainly paid off for you then, I would guess.
I'm sorry?
I guess ROTC certainly paid off for you.
Yeah, I did. It had a great benefit at that particular time.
Now, at this point, of course, very young, very early into your time in the Army, was there anything that you particularly wanted to do? Was there any particular branch that you were kind of gravitating toward?
Well, what I did was this. Back in 1963, I went over and I was looking at joining up. And I went to the Air Force recruiter and I went to the Army. And I was about ready to go to the Air Force, you know, but I went over to the Army and then talked to them. And the recruiter said, said, well, what would you like to do? And for some reason, do not ask me. I said, fly. It just popped into my head. I said, I want to fly.
Hmm.
He says, well, you can't. He said, because you don't have a college degree. I said, oh, okay. So I kissed that off, and I was about ready to go into the Air Force as a jet mechanic, okay, jet engine mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, or the recruiter, called me up, and he said, hey, he said, I was wrong. He said, they have a warrant officer candidate program that you could join up for. So I said, I went back down there and talked to him. I said, yeah, y'all, 3 bags full. So what I did was I went through a normal physical. Then I went up to Vandenberg Air Force Base and took an Air Force flight physical. Then I went through an interview process with a board of officers. I think there was 5 of them. And then I had to wait for my induction date. They scheduled me for a slot into flight school. And so I had to wait for my induction date. And that's why I went between 63 and 64, just waiting to go in. So once I got out of basic training, they gave me 2 weeks leave, and I reported to Fort Walters, Texas for flight school.
Hmm, interesting. You mentioned that they had this interview by this board of officers. Do you recall what went on in this interview? What kind of questions were they asking? What were they trying to find out about you?
Oh, they were just, I don't know, it's been so long ago, I can see them sitting there, but I really can't remember any specific questions that they were asking. It was just, I think, more general than it was anything else.
Yeah, just trying to figure out, I guess, if you had the aptitude for different kinds of things and things like that, I guess, right. Okay, now, Fort Walters, of course, is going to be an absolute hub for helicopter pilots going to Vietnam as well as other parts of the world and the United States. Tell me about training there at Fort Walters. What was that like in these early days?
Well, it wasn't air-conditioned rooms, I'll tell you that for sure. Our class was 65-3 as RW in a rotary wing. And our class had 198 folks in it, I think it was. The class before us had like 40-some-odd. The class after us had something like 40, whatever. Our class was experimental into seeing how many folks you could put in the class and push through the flight school because of Vietnam was kicking in.
Hmm.
You know, I think that's what it was. Anyway, only half of us got through. In fact, it was less than half. I think 48% of us got through, graduated. So, but Fort Walters was, it was a little different. Your upperclassmen, they outranked you, you know, they could harass you. In the pre-flight stage, which was 6 weeks long, you sit there and you go to the mess hall, you had to eat a square meal,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And some guys just fell out during that particular portion. But but then the rest of them fell out during flight school itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it was it wasn't difficult. I was young, 19. You know, I could run 2 miles, do all the rest of that stuff, so that wasn't the issue. So it wasn't all that bad. I just remember that the barracks were just insanely hot. So.
And especially with all those people crowded into it.
Well, yeah, you know, and there's no air conditioner or anything else, and in the brick buildings in Fort Walters in August is not a cool place to be.
Yeah, it gets pretty toasty over there.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what sort of things do you think washed these guys out there at Fort Walters?
I'm sorry?
What do you think washed these guys out? You mentioned that there's a pretty high washout right there.
Yeah, they, some of it was because of the instructors, okay? Some of the instructors had, I guess you'd call it an attitude problem.
Hmm.
When I started out, I had one instructor, and he had a bad problem. Some of these guys had been teaching there for years, and I don't know if they were getting burned out on their jobs or whatever it was. But this guy, he was a screamer. He would sit down, if you do something wrong, he'd scream at you, you know, in your ear set and your headset and stuff. And I've never been one to react to screaming. I have a tendency to back off, just quit, you know. So, but anyway, he was transferred out, lucky for me. And I got this other gentleman called Mr. Hildebrand. He was a retired warrant officer. And he talked to me in a normal voice, and I made it through no problem after that, you know. But there were other guys were talking about people screaming at them, slapping their hands, hitting them across the chest when they screw up and stuff like that. So I think that was some of it.
Yeah. Now, were most of these instructors civilians, or were they military?
No, they were civilian, all of them.
All of them were civilian, okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, you're going to take classroom training here as well, I would assume. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we sure did. We had, we went through weather, mechanics, aerodynamics, the normal stuff, you know. Just learn how to fly, what made the helicopter get up after it beat the air in submission, what made it fly, you know. So, you know, stuff like that. Just normal aeronautic type information that you need to become a pilot, but also you had to learn about why it flew and also the mechanics of the aircraft itself.
So. Right. You'd mentioned that you were somewhat indifferent as a student in high school. How did you take to the academic aspects of training there at Fort Walters?
No, I enjoyed it. It was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not the stellar number one student in the class, but I held my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did all right.
What about the flight instruction? Take me through that process.
The what?
The flight instruction. We're actually getting in the birds.
Well, I think that's peculiar for the simple reason. When I told the guy, the recruiter, that I wanted to fly, I had never been on an airplane in my life.
Hmm.
And I think that was strange. But anyway, they called it a dollar ride. That's where you get up, and the instructor takes you up, and you fly around, and he lets you manipulate some of the controls. There's no grade associated with it or anything else. It's just like an orientation flight.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up for that, and I was looking around, looking at all the scenery below and stuff. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I said, that was great. And so I went on, I started, after that we started the instruction, like I said, I had that one instructor leave, and this other instructor came in, and I picked up on flying fairly good. So, like I said, I wasn't number one, but I was still holding my own within both the ground and the air flight phase. So.
Mm-hmm. What helicopters were you flying at this point?
Well, there's only one at Fort Walters in 1965. It was OH-23D.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Hiller. That's the only one they had.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to learn to fly? You said you took to it pretty well. What sort of things did you find interesting? What sort of things did you find challenging?
Well, since I was so new, okay, to the flight arena, I had nothing go back on, no past history to say, oh, this is unique or that's unique. So I didn't find anything. Everything was just normal to me because it's the first time I'd ever experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find some challenging, like doing auto rotations and stuff like that. And auto rotations, nothing more than a power off landing. that takes a certain technique and stuff, and I found those challenging.
Right.
And that was about it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you might explain, for someone who's not familiar with an auto rotation, could you tell me about this process? To me, it would be very difficult and somewhat unnerving, but take me through the process of learning how to auto rotate.
Well, like I said, auto rotation is nothing more than power off landing. And the engine can be idling, but the sprag clutch will disconnect the rotor system. The rotor systems are all designed that if the collective pitch, that's the up and down stick, is all the way on the bottom, the airflow coming up through it keeps it spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you don't want to stop, okay? It keeps it spinning. So what's the first thing you would do is, if your engine quit, you would take your collective pitch and push it all the way down, okay, and try to maintain your airspeed or whatever airspeed you're supposed to have. It depends on each aircraft. Anyway, and you select an area that you need to land in. Well, you line down and try to line up with your nose into the wind, and you get down to a certain altitude, and it all depends by which aircraft you're in. And then you raise the nose to deplete the airspeed or the forward speed of your aircraft, and it also slows you down. Your vertical speed slows you down both horizontally and vertically. And then there's a certain point, about anywhere between 3 and 15 feet, that you start raising up on the collective pitch, which means it will put a positive pitch in the blades. That slows you down even further, and then you just let the aircraft settle and hit the ground. So
mm-hmm.
It's fairly simple. It sounds complicated, but it's basically simple.
Well, there's another aspect of this that I've heard other helicopter pilots tell me about, and also failed helicopter pilots tell me about, and that is the process to learn how to hover. I've heard this could be difficult for individuals as well. Was that the case for you?
What, hovering?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, if you can hover, you can do anything.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's the most difficult thing in the world to do in a helicopter.
Hmm.
It's because you have all controls. If you have a reciprocating engine, regular piston engine, okay, you've got a throttle you mess with. There's one control. You've got your collective pitch, which raises the aircraft up and down. There's another control. You have your cyclic control that keeps you from rolling and nose pitch up and down and all the rest of stuff. Then you have your pedals for your yaw, okay, that makes your nose go left to right. And so it's the only maneuver in a helicopter that it takes all of them at once.
Hmm.
To do it right.
Right.
Yes, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to do that, but they gave you about 17 hours to learn anyway. So.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the hours there on hovering. How many hours did you have to complete in general there, flying the helicopter, before you were graded out, that you were okay to fly?
Are you talking about just Fort Walters?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Are you talking about flying solo?
Yes, flying solo.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, they could solo you anytime. The instructor could solo you anytime he wanted to, you know. I think I had 13 or 14 hours, okay, and then I soloed. Then after that, you could fly by yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, just in specific areas and do specific maneuvers. But your instructor had to clear you for each one of these maneuvers, you know. But you could do it, and then after X number of hours, then if you passed your final check ride, then you were off to Fort Rucker.
Hmm. Now, when did you go off to Fort Rucker?
I'm sorry?
When did you go off to Fort Rucker after you finished here?
Yeah, that was, I remember those dates too. It was the 3rd of December, 1965.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I left.
Right. Now, you're going to get some more advanced training there at Fort Rucker, and you're probably going to be in different helicopters. Tell me about your time at Fort Rucker.
Well, when we first got there, we went into an H-19 transition, and that was the worst helicopter I think anybody ever made. I hated that stinking thing. But and also, that was the only check ride I ever flunked, was an H-19. But anyway, I flunked the first one, but I passed the second one. And then from there, we went over and started flying tactics. And we went out in the field, and we did some work out of the airfields. Then we go out to the field and actually fly, you know, out in the boonies and stuff. But we did that in an H-19, and then the last phase that we had was instruments, and we were the first. also transitioned into a Buick at that particular time. So it was just more of the same as Fort Walters, but it wasn't quite as challenging as Fort Walters, because Fort Walters were all brand new. You're trying to learn a brand new skill.
So. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what was it that you did not like about the H-19? This is a pretty big bird. What was it you didn't like about it?
Well, it was so underpowered, it was absolutely pathetic. On a hot day, you'd have to pull the collective all the way up as far as pull in max power as much as you could, and the thing wouldn't even fly, wouldn't even get off the ground. And, but you've got max power in. And so what you do is just let it sit there for a minute. And if you kept the power in, it eventually come on up to about 3 feet, and then you could hover up and do your thing. So underpowered. It had a collective. The collective did not have hydraulics on it, and the pedals did not have hydraulics. The cyclic did, but the collective always wanted to go down, and the right pedal always wanted to go all the way to the floor. So your left side was horrendously built up, because you always have to hold the collective up and push on that left pedal. And I remember getting out of the aircraft the first couple of times I flew it, and you wake up the next morning, and my whole left side is just totally sore. But I didn't like that aircraft. It just did not. It was just sort of thrown together, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like a real physical workout as well.
It was. It didn't. It just didn't work well.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned learning to fly tactics. What sort of things were you involved in flying tactics? What did this consist of?
Well, they called it tactics. What we'd do is we'd go out there and we'd fly like specific scenarios at different altitudes. Most of the time it was fairly low at night and stuff like this. We'd go above ground altitude and take off and fly a specific pattern. We had to make it within a certain time frame and stuff. Go to A to B, and you need to be there at a certain time, and B to C, and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's basically what we did. We're just learning how to fly mission-oriented type flights. So.
Mm-hmm. So when you're finished with the H-19, you go to the Huey, I believe you said.
Yeah,
what was it like transitioning from the H-19 to the UH-1?
Going from hell to heaven.
I hear a lot of people say that.
Yeah, it's just, oh Lord. A Huey is so easy to fly, okay? It really is. It's a real simple bird, you know. I enjoyed flying it. It was just real easy to fly. So
mm-hmm.
It was nice.
Well, give me some more technical background on this, if you could. What made the Huey so much easier to fly?
Well, first of all, it had hydraulics on everything. So you didn't have to sit there and strain yourself trying to get the collective up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was very forgiving if the hydraulics went out, and you had to learn how to fly it that way too. It was still controllable, it was just a little different, but it was very controllable without the hydraulics as well. You know. And if you lost the hydraulics in H-19, I don't think you could control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it was just it flew well, it felt comfortable. Get a lot of confidence flying that thing.
Yeah. I guess they have to train you on the lesser helicopters before they will turn you loose on the better ones, I guess.
Well, yeah. They did away with the H-19 not too long, too much longer after that.
Yeah. Now, what kind of flying are you doing in the Huey? Same kind of tactics flying, things like that?
No, it was just instrument flight.
Oh, okay.
So that's all we were doing.
Yeah.
And then Then they break us out, I think it was for a week or something in there, and then we'd go out and shoot auto rotation stuff like this and get transitioned into a Huey,
mm-hmm.
you know. So.
Right.
And the transition was very simple, going from H-19 to a Huey.
Sure. I wonder if you might tell me about Fort Rucker. How many people are there? How many people are in your unit? What is the pace of life there at Fort Rucker? Because, again, this is, 1965 and 1960, yeah, I guess 1965. I would assume that it would be pretty darn busy there at Fort Rucker with as many pilots as they're trying to run through there. What was it like there at Fort Rucker, the pace of life?
Well, at that particular time, they just didn't have, it wasn't the big cruncho that was to come.
Mm-hmm.
the, like I said, the class after me was 40. The class in front of me was 40. We showed up over there with about 50-some-odd folks, you know, had to go through school. So it really wasn't all that, the warrant officer candidates, there just wasn't that many of us there at the particular time. But they did have, now, that was rotary wing. They did have fixed wing classes, and we had a sister class, 65-3 fixed wing. Now, they were there. I don't know exactly how many was in their class, though. So.
Yeah.
Now, there just wasn't a whole bunch of us there.
Right. Obviously, the Vietnam War is in the background here, and it's building up. Did you have a sense that, as a helicopter pilot, that you may wind up in what's going on over in Vietnam?
Yeah. We used to sit down and watch Uncle Wally at night, you know, on the boob tube there in the day room. And it was always, they always had something about Vietnam on. And every time they'd show something about Vietnam, there was a helicopter in the scene somewhere. And so, as time was going on and on, I just looked and I go, well, I'm going to wind up over there sooner or later. So when it came time for us to put in the dream sheet, they call it, and it's asking for assignments where you want to be assigned to, I just put all three was Vietnam. Just let it go. And so I basically volunteered for Vietnam. Of course, they took it.
Right.
And I had other guys come in and they told me I was going to get my butt blown off on this and stuff. But regardless of where they went, I had a couple of my classmates, they went all the way to Germany with their household goods, their families and everything else. They stayed there 2 months and was reassigned back to the 1st Cavalry Division, or 11th Air Assault Division at Fort Rucker. Fort Benning, Georgia, that turned into the 1st Cavalry Division and was sent to Vietnam. So they came to Vietnam whether they wanted to or not.
Right.
But the difference was, I remember Stevenson, he was a classmate of mine, he came over with a cab, and he was infused into my company, of all things. And because what they did is everybody hit over there at the same time, everybody had the same departure date to go home. Well, that's whole division would leave. So what they did was they took aviators and infantry and everything else from all over the country and fused them back and forth. They started swamping people to get the derosers more mixed up, so not everybody would leave at once. And so that's what happened to Stevenson. He came into me, and I was living in a two-man, room with Ivan C. Dunn and another classmate of mine. And we had our own Johns and most of the places air-conditioned. We had a nice bar, you know, and stuff like that. And he came out of the first cab, and they had no tents. Wherever you landed your helicopter, that's where you spent the night. And they lived like pigs, you know, and stuff like that. And I told him, I said, okay, I might have volunteered, but I think I came out better than you guys did. So.
Now, you put your name in on this dream sheet for Vietnam. I mean, is this, knowing what was going on there, and you talked about watching the news with Walter Cronkite and just had an idea. Did you know what was going on there? Did you have a good idea of how the war was shaping up over there?
No, not really. Like I said, every time we watched the news, it was Vietnam, and every time you saw Vietnam, you saw helicopters. It was just the two were synonymous with each other. And I'm going, you know, as much, if that's the case, if Vietnam builds up or stays the same as it is right now, it's going to, I'll probably wind up going over there sooner or later, so just let me go now.
Did you have any trepidation, any worries or concerns about going?
No.
And, of course, obviously you're in your early 20s at this point, so that probably makes a difference as well.
Yeah. I was 20 years old.
21. When did you finish up your training?
I do know. It was 11th May. That's when I graduated. 11th May, 1965.
65, there we go. Yes, I guess it would have been 66, or 65, yes.
Yeah.
Do you receive your orders then that you're going to Vietnam?
No, I'd had them. We'd already had them.
You already had them. Okay. So you knew that was going to be the case. So you finish up there at Fort Rucker. Do you have any time off after your last check ride and you graduated there, do you have any time off to go back home?
Oh yeah, we all as soon as we graduated, everybody jumped in their new cars or whatever and split. You know, I went out to Tucson, Arizona, where folks lived at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 30 days there with them.
I wonder if you can tell me what it was like during that 30-day leave before you went off to Vietnam. You know that you're going. Are you paying any more attention to what's going on in the news about Vietnam? Are your parents talking to you about what their thoughts might be on this?
Okay, that's one of those blank spots you're talking about. I don't have any memories of being even at the house.
Okay.
I have nothing.
Interesting. You know you're going to Vietnam. You have a 30-day leave. Tell me about leaving from Tucson, I guess, to Vietnam. What was the process?
Well, I got it that morning. I was taking a flight out of Tucson and going flying up to San Francisco. And from there, I'd go out to Travis Air Force Base and catch a jet over. And so I remember getting up and I put on my uniform, all the rest of this crud. And so Mom was taking me to the airport, and I figured she was going to start bawling any time. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I wasn't looking forward to that because you never want to see your mother cry.
Right.
And so anyway, I got there, I go up to the ticket counter. We didn't have all this minutiae like we have today. And I go up to the ticket counter, and she says, "You better hurry." She says, "They're about ready to take off." Well, I misread the ticket. So I didn't have time to watch her cry. Cause I told her, I said, "Bye, Mom. I got to go give her a kiss," and started running toward the airplane, which I made, by the way. And so that was my takeoff there. It wasn't emotional.
Yeah. So you fly out to San Francisco. You're leaving out of Travis Air Force Base. What was that trip like? Who are you on the plane with? What's going on this flight over to Vietnam?
Well, there was a whole bunch of my classmates on there with me, too. Ivan C. Dunn was there. Duke Holcroft was there. John Bishop was there. I think about five or six of us went over.
Mm-hmm.
For my class, you know, so I had some buddies there.
Yeah.
And it was an extremely long flight. In fact, I think everybody on the aircraft was just really happy to get to Vietnam, whether you're going to get shot at or not. Simple reason is we got on board the aircraft, took off from there, stopped in Hawaii, had a layover there for a while, and left some people off because this was not a specifically bound aircraft for Vietnam. It was going all the way to Vietnam, but it had several stops. So anyway, we get back on the aircraft, take off again. I remember we stopped at Okinawa. We stopped in the Philippines, and I think Guam or Wake or something like this. There was a couple of two or three more stops. And to make a long story short, I didn't think I was ever going to get to Vietnam because every time we did something, we were having to make another stop. You know, let people off, pick people up. So I was just real happy to get there.
Where did you come into Vietnam?
Tonsonut.
At Tonsonut. All right. Tell me about getting off the plane and seeing Tonsonut. What are your memories of your first experiences in Vietnam?
Well, I tell you what, that's the one thing that stands out even to this day. They open the door, and the first thing that happens, you're in this aircraft that's been cooled. You know, it's very comfortable, it's very nice, cool. And the first thing that hits you is that heat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the heat coming in and the humidity and everything. But what really got to me was the smell. It wasn't bad, but it was so unique. It was like you landed in a field. Rotting vegetation. That's what it smelled like. It had a very, very unique smell to it, and I can still smell it. I think it's sort of unique. So.
All right, you step off the plane, Tonsonut. You're greeted with the humidity and the heat and the smell, and this is what I hear a lot of people say. What's the next step? Do you know what outfit you're going to be assigned to at this point?
Well, they pick us up. As they get us off, they'll say, "Hey, all you warrant officers, come over here. All you commissioned officers, go over there." So that's what we did. And then once we got into this little briefing room, then they started telling us where we were going to go, and we spent the night over at the 120th BOQ there in Saigon, and the next day we flew out to our respective companies.
Hmm.
Mine was Benoit, and it was only like a 15-minute flight. So.
Right. Now, how did you get from the BOQ to Benoit?
Oh, they bussed us over to the hotel pad or something like that. I forget what it was. Anyway, one of the Hueys from the company flew down and picked us up.
Mm-hmm. Now, a little bit ago, you were in Tucson, Arizona. Air conditioning, life was fine. Now you find yourself in Benoit in Vietnam, and there's a war going on. What was it like to arrive in Benoit, your unit?
I don't remember anything bad, anything exciting, nothing like that. I just, in fact, I don't even remember arriving, per se.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I did, but
sure.
I don't remember going through hardly anything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't remember going to BOQ.
Hmm.
You'll have to forgive me, but I've got a lot of blank spaces in there. So.
No, that's quite all right, quite all right. Now, I wonder, was there any sort of in-country orientation as to the people and the land and the culture or anything like this at this point?
No. Uh-uh.
Yeah.
We just went up, and then we couldn't get infused in the company when we first got there, like to take our check rides and everything else. Because the company was doing a massive haul with some other companies as well from a huge battle they had had up at Dong Zhuai,
mm-hmm.
and they were hauling bodies for like 3 days.
Wow,
so.
That would be pretty sobering, I would think.
Yeah, well, I wasn't there. I was sitting in the BOQ. They couldn't do anything with us.
They didn't see anything of that. Okay. Yeah, the battle that you mentioned obviously is a pretty famous one for the unit, but that took place just before you arrived, I guess.
Right. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, tell me about coming into the unit. Now, this is A Company of the 501st, correct?
Right.
All right. Tell me about coming into this company. Who was the CEO? How was it arranged? How many helicopters do you have there? Give me the rundown on A Company of the 501st.
Well, Major Henderson was our commander. One heck of a fine man and commander. Okay, he was a very moral man, very good man. And I was so, in retrospect, I was so lucky to have him as a first commander. You know, but we came in. I was assigned to first platoon, and Duke Schwimm was the platoon leader. And I got scheduled for a check ride, and I think I went up with Bold Shelton for a check ride. And I passed that, and then I was infused and just go up and start flying missions. Because they had aircraft commanders, and then they had Peter pilots. Now, before you could be an aircraft commander, you had to pass check rides and be recommended and all the rest of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Know what you were doing. And but the rest of the company was basically just, I think we had eight helicopters per platoon. That we had first, second platoon, and then the third platoon was the gunships.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how many they had in there. It was probably eight as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you mentioned that your commander there, Major Henderson, was a, what you say, is a fine man and a fine leader. What sort of things would he do to let you know or to make you believe that he was such a fine leader, such a fine man? What sort of specific things do you have in mind?
Well, he would. He didn't do it all the time, but a lot of times he would fly with us. I flew with him just one time, okay? But he would always fly tail end Charlie, you know, back aircraft, because he could see the rest of the flight flying and how his pilots were doing, you know, how they were flying.
Right.
And so he was a good guy. The little interface that I did have with him was very positive. That's a feeling. I can't tell you specifics,
mm-hmm.
you know, about anything. But it's just, he's just a good guy, you know.
Yeah.
So.
All right, you mentioned that you had to have so much time as a Peter pilot, as they were called. How long would it take to between your check rides and your familiarization flights around the country, and the AO and all that sort of stuff, how long would it take before you were cleared to become an aircraft commander?
Well, it varied. I think it normally was about 90 days. That's what it took me.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing during these 90 days, you personally? What are you doing?
Well, what you're doing is you're flying as a co-pilot, okay, with an aircraft commander, and you're learning how to fly within the AO, learning how to fly a QE under certain conditions like combat assault or resupply missions or some of the goofy areas you had to fly into, and just learning basically techniques and judgment and all those neat things like that to make sure that you're successful at doing what you're doing and don't get anybody killed while you're at it.
Mm-hmm. And is the aircraft commander talking to you about these things the entire time? This is why we're approaching this way. This is why we're going in here.
Yeah, they're sure.
And I would guess it would be different depending on the individuals and how that relationship would develop, I guess.
Right.
Are you working with the same pilot all the time, or are they moving you from pilot to pilot to pilot?
I flew with a whole bunch of different guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'd fly with Old Shelton some, and I'd fly with this other guy some, Kent Mandel some.
Yeah, and that would stand to reason. You get a variety of different perspectives, and different pilots are doing things different ways, and you can kind of learn from all of them this way, I would assume, would be the point there.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So for 90 days you're doing this. You talked about whether it's a combat assault, or you're hauling things, or moving personnel, or whatever it may be. What types of memories come up when you think about, say, these first 90 days? For example, say a combat assault.
Well, I can't remember the combat assaults, to be perfectly honest with you, the first 90 days. But I do remember in the first 90 days, I was flying with Ken Linville, and that was the first time I ever heard somebody shoot at me. I remember that because it sounds like popcorn.
What was that like to know you were being fired at?
Nothing, because they weren't hitting anything.
That would make a difference, I guess.
Well, yeah, if you hear the sound, that means the bullets passed you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So you didn't get hit, so who cares?
Right.
It's, when you get hit, you don't hear the sound. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't getting hit or anything else, but I do remember that. But all the rest of the stuff was combat assaults were not my forte, because the aircraft would bounce around so much because all the rotor wash and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I could do them, and I was successful at it, so didn't like doing them, but I did them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're flying the Slicks, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, well, take me through the process, and for someone who may be listening to this interview or reading the transcript, take me through the process of going on a combat assault from the time that you show up at the pad to, you know, pre-flight and all these things, and how a combat assault would form together and how it would take place from the very beginning to the very end.
Well, we'd show up and do the pre-flight and stuff. The first thing we did prior to pre-flight, we'd always get in the briefing room of the operations shed out there on next to the helipad. And we'd go through, and usually the commander, Major Henderson, would tell us mission, how many lifts we were going to do that day, 5, 10, whatever, who we were carrying, where were we going, what were we trying to do, accomplish. It was a total mission brief.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we get that, then we'd go on out, pre-flight our aircraft and get it ready to go. While we were in doing the mission brief and stuff, the crew chiefs had already been out there prior to us showing up, and the gunners, and they'd already dailied the aircraft. They had all the ammunition aboard for the machine guns, and the gunners would get the machine guns out in place. So we were basically ready to go after the pre-flight. And so we would just sit there and wait for the signal to go ahead and crank up. And generally speaking, while we were doing this, a lot of times the soldiers would already be there at the heliport, and we didn't have to fly anywhere to pick them up. And if that was the case, then what we'd do, the crew chief would load all the troops in that we'd do, we'd crank the aircraft up, and then we'd take off. Generally, we'd take off one at a time because the rotor wash, we were flying D models at the time, and they didn't have a whole bunch of power to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd all take off. And then we'd link up as we flew, and we all, the vast majority of times, we would way you were up behind them, blah, 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 blah. That was it. It would keep the company aircraft fairly compact in size, and so you could land in much smaller LZs,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also give you more room to maneuver while you were there. So anyway, we'd do that. We'd go in and offload the first load. If there was fire being received, you were saving small arms fire, then the crew chief would drop, or the gunner would drop a smoke grenade. It would be an open air broadcast of it, and then the gunships would come in and try to suppress the fire as you were going in. But if you didn't receive any, well, then that was better.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you go in, drop off, and you would just repeat that same scenario over and over and over again until you got all the troops in that you wanted to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one particular time, that was the longest combat assault I'd ever been on. We got to the airfield at 5 o'clock in the morning. I think we took off at 5:30 or 6. And I got back to the BOQ at 5 that night.
It's a long day.
And we flew the whole time.
Very long day.
Yeah, it was, I forget how many lifts we put in.
Mm-hmm.
But the mess sergeant came by in a 3/4 ton and gave us, that's how we had lunch. He gave us a Coke each and a sandwich each. And so the gunner and the co-pilot might be eating, and I was flying. The crew chief was back there just with his gun. And then after they got through eating, then we'd switch over and we'd eat, you know, and stuff like this. But that was the longest I'd ever, it was a combat assault. And like I said, I can't remember how many people we put in, but there was a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, during these first 90 days, say, for example, during a combat assault, were you attached to a specific unit that you were transporting, moving into the zones and out?
We supported anybody in 3 Corps.
Anybody in 3 Corps, okay.
Right, anybody who needed our support.
Now, were they primarily American or Vietnamese?
Vietnamese.
Vietnamese, okay. Now, when you're loading up the troops, the Arvin troops, how many would you typically have in one of these D-model Hueys?
I couldn't tell you. Can't remember. I just know we'd take a bunch of them.
Right.
They also didn't have something. You might have heard this by other pilots. They called it ACR, aircraft loading.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They didn't have aircraft loading when I was there. You threw on as many as you fit. If you couldn't take off, you threw a couple off.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I can't remember how many Vietnamese we could put in there.
Yeah.
But whatever we could, that's what we'd take off with.
Yeah, I've heard that as well, especially there in the early days.
That's correct.
Down south, it didn't become quite as streamlined or as efficient as maybe perhaps would become later on for something like that.
Sure.
Now, were you solely working with the Vietnamese at this time?
No, back then, when I first got there in June of 65, the Big Red One was the only people there in the 173rd Airborne Brigade,
mm-hmm.
And they were right outside of the fence there at Benoit Air Force Base. And but we would go in and help the Big Red One every once in a while, and we used to support the 173rd fairly often on their operation.
Mm-hmm.
But there was infinitely more Vietnamese units than there were American units.
Sure.
So the preponderance of our missions were for Vietnamese.
Yeah, especially at this early time.
Yeah.
You've told me about the pre-flighting. You've told me, or the pre-flight briefing, moving in on the combat assault, moving out. What do you do when the day's mission is over?
Are over?
Yes.
Well, we usually wound up back at the if you were on a combat assault, everybody would come back in as a whole company, you know, and land and get your spot set her down, and then we'd all make out the logbook and all the rest of that stuff, do whatever we had to. Generally speaking, there was no post-mission briefing, so all we'd do is pack up our gear and stuff, go over and jump on the deuce and a half, and the driver would take us back to DOQ.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly simple. We didn't do anything fancy.
Right.
And the crew chiefs and the gunner would take all the machine guns and he'd make sure they were cleaned and ready to go for the next day's missions. Make sure he had enough ammo in, replenish that. Crew chief would do whatever he needed to do to get the aircraft ready for the next day's missions.
Mm-hmm.
Basically what we did.
Okay. You mentioned the BOQ. I wonder if you might take me or tell me about the living conditions that you encountered there.
Like I said, it was pretty good. We had two man room. It was an L shaped BOQ, and between the L's there was a cubby hole, not a cubby hole, it was a fairly good sized little branch in there, and that's where we had our bar. Everybody had their own bathrooms and stuff like that. We never had a problem with electricity, blah, blah, blah. So none of us were air-conditioned. The commander and a couple of other guys had air-conditioned rooms, but that was it.
Mm-hmm. What about other facilities, like mess facilities or medical facilities, things like that?
Well, the mess hall was right there in the same compound. It was a separate building that was sitting right next to the BOQ, and all they had to do is walk across to it, what, maybe 10 feet, 15 feet, something like that.
Okay.
So it was right there with us. The medical facilities, the flight surgeon was down, he was on the Benoit Air Base. That's where his facilities were.
Okay. Now, you've come into this unit, green pilot straight from the United States. You're going out on these rides, whether you're hauling troops or combat assault or whatever it may be that you're going out on these missions, these different types of flights. What was it like to become integrated into the unit? I mean, were there older guys there, these older salts, so to speak, who were offering advice, who were the people you had to talk to and look up to and learn from? What was the dynamic within that particular company, in that particular platoon even?
Well, all the guys, the older guys, I'm talking about the older guys, not the guys who've been there longer than that particular year. The guys who had more flying experience and stuff like this, they were always very, very helpful trying to get you up to speed if they saw a weakness in what you were trying to accomplish or the technique that you were using to accomplish a certain mission or stuff. But they would gladly share their knowledge with you, help you out any way you could, any way they could. You know, it was the camaraderie was quite high.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, was this? Did you associate mostly with other pilots, or you associating with ground crew and gunners and things like that? What kind of folks did you typically associate with?
Well, in the company was not side by side together. The BOQ was downtown.
Mm-hmm.
I lived downtown Benoit in this BOQ. The enlisted personnel, crew chiefs, gunners, and everyone else, they lived on Benoit Air Base themselves. And so the only person that you could associate with after hours was your fellow pilots, because that's the only people you were around.
Mm-hmm. So. Sure. That makes perfect sense, obviously, yeah. What sort of things would you do in your downtime when you come back to the BOQ at night? Music or food or, I don't want to say sightseeing, but, you know, Benoit was a lot different from Tucson or Coleman or Carlsbad.
Yeah, well, sometimes when we'd have stand-down days, we had a day off on occasion, we'd all go downtown and look around the shops and stuff like this. I remember doing that. And then at night, sometimes they would have movies, and they'd show them in the mess hall and stuff. And that was about it. Every once in a while, everybody would get tanked up in the bar, Did that often, not that often, but every once in a while.
All right.
So anyway, it was just typical, whatever you could do right there.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, a lot of folks wrote letters home and received letters home. How active were you in writing letters, if at all?
Oh, I can't remember how often I did it. I guess, pretty steady.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, something like that. I
mm-hmm.
can't really remember.
Yeah.
At least, let's put it this way. My mother didn't chew my rear out, so I guess I was doing okay.
Just enough to keep her off of you, if nothing else, I guess. How often would you receive letters from home?
I don't know that either.
Yeah, yeah.
I sure received more than what I sent.
That's not surprising. surprising for a 21-year-old, I guess. Well, what sort of things would you put in your letters?
Oh, I would just tell her about what we did for the day and stuff like this. Nothing bad in there.
Right.
Didn't want her. I figured her imagination was going to open up anyway, so didn't
right.
need to feed it.
Sure, sure.
And so I just talked to her about different things, maybe people we had met or we had hauled or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Just general BS stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, the last thing you want to do is obviously worry your parents about something like that.
That is correct.
Yes, sir. Now, you said it was about 90 days before you became an aircraft commander. Do you remember your first flight as aircraft commander?
I can't remember the first flight, but I remember going to the airfield. I can't remember what we did.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it was some real small little mission. They tried to break in fairly easy. So.
Mm-hmm. And again, that stands to reason, obviously. What is the, can you give me an example of the first flight you do remember as an aircraft commander? I mean, this may not be something that sticks with you, obviously, because you've flown, as Peter pilot, and sometimes you're flying, and sometimes the aircraft commander is flying, so they might get a little mixed up in a person's memory, obviously. You can see how that could happen. But do you remember any particular mission that you were on early on in your time as an aircraft commander where you're the guy who's in charge?
Oh, I remember some missions. I don't remember if it was early on or not.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember some missions that I flew.
Yeah. Well, tell me about some of those.
Well, let's see. There was one. I'll tell you about the best mission I ever flew. How's that?
Okay, please do.
I'm not an aircraft commander. I'm a Peter pilot, but I was flying with John Clapp, who was. We were flying out of Dao Chiang for the Special Forces, and they had a big group, I forget which group headquarters or whatever, in Dao Chiang. And we were flying for them for ash and trash. In other words, we were doing all the administrative runs and hauling people, doing whatever we had to do to support them for the day. Well, we were going past this little compound called Menton. And it was a Special Forces triangular compound. Anyway, they got a call from them. It was a blanket call. It says, aircraft flying over, blah, blah, code word. It says, who are you? And so I called them back, because John was flying, and I told him our call sign. He said, we need you to land. So anyway, I called back, said, Dao Chiang, and they said, yeah, if they need you, just go ahead and land. So we did. And they told us to shut down and come on in. And so we shut down outside the triangle compound and walked in, and we went to the mess hall. There was a guy sitting at the end of the table, and I still remember it was vividly clear to me. And he had black on, and there was a whole bunch of Special Forces, NCOs, sitting at the table drinking coffee, and he was down there eating. And so we got ourselves a cup of coffee, and the crew chief and gunner did too. We were all sitting there. And so anyway, they had this one E-7 who grabbed and brought it in. I said, what's going on? Said, you see that guy down at the end? I said, yeah. He said, that's Isaac Camacho. I said, who's he? He said, he just walked in this morning. He's been a POW for 5 years.
Really?
Yes. And so I had John Clapp and I had the distinct privilege of taking the first walk out POW to freedom.
That's incredible.
That's best mission I ever flew.
Wow. Tell me more about that, and tell me about the individual.
Well, he was a Special Forces guy, and he had been captured, and I think it was 5 years. It could have been less. You would have to forgive me if some of my dates were off.
No, sure, of course.
But anyway, he had been captured, and he had been held somewhere. He didn't know where. He didn't know if it was in Cambodia, where. But anyway, he had been held in a prison camp, and got himself together this little survival kit, and it was leaves and anything else he could cram into it that he thought he needed to use for survival. And at one particular time, I think it was the evening time or something, he had found an opportunity to slip out of the camp, and he did. And that was five, that had been 5 days previous. Excuse me. And so he had walked, he just walked east, because he said if he walked east, he knew eventually he'd run into something, if nothing more than the ocean.
Right.
And if he ran into the ocean, then he knew who he was. Okay.
Right.
So anyway, he just started walking east, and he walked day and night for 5 days. And he said he didn't want to stop, because he felt that they were tracking him, trying to find him.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kept walking for 5 days and five nights. He ran into the Menton, this triangular compound. And he came in, and they brought him in, you know, his stuff, I guess, sitting down at the table. And he walked in just a little while before we showed up. And he was sitting down there getting a good, his first good meal in X number of years. And I thought it was pretty interesting that, not interesting, I thought it was, showed you how weak he was. He got through eating, or what he could eat. He couldn't eat that much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he got up, and they took him back to the back. There was a shower, and anyway, he was going to get a shower, and there was something, I heard a noise or something, a couple of big old E7s jumped up, went back to the back, and when that, he was so tired from walking all that distance, that when that warm water hit him, he collapsed.
Oh, wow.
He didn't have the strength to stand up. And so here's these big old E7, you know, Special Forces soldiers, infantry types, tough as nails, sitting there taking care of their brother. They took wash rags and soap and stuff, and they washed him up themselves,
hmm.
You know, like he would a baby.
Yeah.
You know, but they took care of him. I was always, that will always stick in my brain, you know. That was true camaraderie.
Yeah, that's an incredible scene, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And you all were...
Also,
I'm sorry, please, go ahead.
No, I was just going to comment that as we were flying toward Benoit, Isaac, was sitting in a jump seat between John Clamp and I. And I went back and tapped him or got his attention, and I pointed and I said, Benoit. And you could see a big old tear come out of his eye. So,
hmm. Now, did you get a chance to talk to him very much, or was it just maybe too much for him? Yeah.
No. Everything I relayed to you, I got out of the E7.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that must have, you guys must have felt just incredible to be able to bring him back.
Yeah, that was the best mission I ever played.
Hmm. Now, when you bring him back and you take him back to Benoit, what's the next step? Where do you take him? What process does he go through?
They had a three-corps headquarters right there, too. In fact, it was right next to our helipad, the big fence separating us, but they had their own helipad. So we landed on their helipad, and a bunch of guys came out and picked up Sergeant Camacho, okay, and took him into headquarters, and I never saw him again.
Hmm. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on our a website right now, and I see some information about Isaac Camacho and his escape. That's truly... it's an incredible story, especially to be such a young man, so new in country, to have the opportunity to be involved in something like that. That's really incredible. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Pitts. When you do become an aircraft commander, you're now responsible for not just yourself and the helicopter, but everyone else in the helicopter, because you're going to have a co-pilot or a Peter pilot. You're going to have a gunner. You're going to have a crew chief that you're responsible for. Was this... added responsibility, was this something that you thought about as being a heavy responsibility? Were you proud to do it? What do you feel when you are now in charge of not just the bird, but in charge of these, or responsible for these people as well?
I didn't feel anything different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was still a pilot. We were all a team. Okay, we got that established real early in life. You can't operate the aircraft without a crew chief. Door gunner to help protect the other side of the aircraft that the crew chief doesn't sit on. Okay, you've got a co-pilot over there who flies as well as you, so you have to fly. Everybody's got their own job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a team as you go up. And it's like the crew chief gunner always felt real responsible about keeping us two stupid pilots up there in the front safe, because they had the machine guns in the back.
Right.
Okay. And so I didn't feel anything like added responsibility or nothing else along all had a job to do, and we tried to do it as professionally as we could.
Yeah, yeah. Now, who were you, say on a, however regular the basis might be, you fly in a combat assault, say that it's a hot LZ, you're being shot at. What enemy are you facing? Is this primarily VC down south at this time, I would assume?
Yeah, The NVA wasn't around, I don't think. There might have been some, but if it was, it's minimal.
Yeah, it was way too early for that kind of that kind of presence for them down that far south, I would think, for sure. Well, can you tell me about the enemy? What sort of characteristics did you see from the air and from your experience with them?
About what?
About the enemy, about their fighting capabilities, about how they would approach a firefight, what sort of activities would they be involved in terms of tactics?
I didn't see any of that when I was flying slips, because the only thing you'd look down, I never saw one.
Hmm.
Never saw a VC.
Hmm. Is that right? Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
You know, they were in the jungles. The only thing I did is when we were doing combat missions or whatever was just concentrate on what I was supposed to be doing,
mm-hmm.
You know. Because
yeah.
The bullet was going to come up and then clip me, when the bullet was going to come up and clip me. But I don't be concerned with it. Just concentrate on what you're doing.
Right, sure. That makes perfect sense, obviously, yeah. Well, what about the Arvin that you encountered? What about the South Vietnamese? What was your impression of them?
They weren't too good of soldiers, but I think it was because of the officers in charge were not very good.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time we went in and we were taking fire coming in with this LZ, dropped them off. So we dropped off the first load. When we came back for the second load, we're still getting fire going into LZ. And the Vietnamese we dropped off the first load are building their fires and cooking their lunch.
Hmm.
You know? So
yeah.
That's not the way you're supposed to do it. So.
Right. It obviously sounds like a leadership failure more than anything else, it would seem to me. Did you see that difference? I mean, I hear a lot of people talk about the individual Arvin soldiers. Like, these are guys who are doing their jobs, but it was their leadership that oftentimes failed them in terms of what they told them to do or not do, things like that. Did you see that to be the case?
I think so. Every once in a while, there was I can't remember the unit. But there was one unit that I was always liked to carry in, because they were Vietnamese, they were very good.
Mm-hmm.
They were very good.
Yeah.
You know, they were disciplined, they knew what to do, they knew how to do it. You didn't have to tell them or threaten them to push them off the aircraft or anything else. They're, heck, half the time, by the time your skids touch down the ground, they're already out of it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Did you encounter South Vietnamese units that you had to be more forceful with? Got to kick them off. You got to kick them out to get them out. Did you encounter that as well?
I didn't, but other people did in the units. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's like Duke Holcroft. He had he was a classmate of mine. The last guy off his aircraft threw a grenade back in.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it was a dud.
Wow, isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd give you a whole new appreciation for for at least a different perspective, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
On things, huh? Interesting. Well, one more question about the Vietnamese, and you were living in town there in Ben Hoa. What kind of contact did you have with the Vietnamese citizens?
Well, basically, most of the contact you had was with the hooch maids, you know, and the people who worked just around the BOQ, basically,
mm-hmm.
You know. Didn't have too much on the outside. Some of the vendors that you'd go, like, get a pair of pants made or something like this. But that was not on a daily basis or even a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I think that probably brings us to a good place to stop for today, Mr. Pitts.
Okay.
This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Archie Pitts. Today is 5 June 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Pitts is joining me again by telephone from his home in McKinney, Texas. All right, Mr. Pitts, we were talking last time about this first tour. You were with A Company of the 501st, and you were giving me the rundown of your overall experiences early on in country there. And we were speaking off of the recorder a moment ago about the 173rd Airborne Brigade, which is a pretty famous unit, obviously, for all of its efforts there in Vietnam. I wonder if you could start off today by telling me about working with the 173rd, some of the missions that you may have encountered with them, what your job would have been with the 173rd.
Well, we, like I've said previously, we did take those guys in on combat assaults, and we also supported them on the administrative side of the house, as well as resupply in the field and stuff like this. So there were several combat assaults we did with them. How many, I could not tell you. You know, memory's a little fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
But we did support them. And there were several times we took them in. They had massive amounts of deployment and stuff like this. You know, a large amount of their troops would go out the field, and then sometimes it would be a small amount depending on what kind of operation they were running. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, but there were we support them. They were good troops. They were a delight to support.
I wonder why you say that. You spent most of your tour, I believe you said, with flying Arvin in and out, but this obviously is an American unit. What kind of differences did you see? I mean, you were obviously impressed with the 173rd. What kind of differences did you see between them?
Well, the big thing was this. The delineation factor was if you went in to supply, let's say, an Arvin, division or whatever, out in the field, chances are you are going to have to offload your own aircraft. Those guys were going to sit down and cook their lunch or whatever, okay? You didn't get any support from them. You supported them,
mm-hmm.
but you got no support from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so helping you do menial tasks like that. So, but the 173rd, what they would do is when we would come in, the guys would jump up. The Australian troops did the same thing, by the way, and they would come over and help you offload. I would sit in the LZ for a very minimal amount of time, you know,
mm-hmm.
and when you start talking a hot LZ with bullets flying, yeah, that's very, very beneficial. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
So I appreciated their endeavor very, very much, you know, and I'm sure they appreciated us coming in resupplying them. You know, but they were there to help us as well, and I just really appreciate it from a flyer's standpoint.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned sitting there on the ground in a hot LZ. What was that like? I mean, for someone who's never experienced it, myself included, what was it like to fly into what you knew was a hot LZ, having to get in there and get out of there, and having bullets flying around you while you're there? What does that do to a person?
Actually, I don't remember that much about it. Okay. The only thing I remember is that you just, like I said previously, you concentrated on getting the mission done.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys on the ground were dependent upon you to bring them supplies so they could do their mission, you know. And so if you, what I did is I distinctly remember concentrating, you know, on just trying to get the supplies to them. And I'm not worried about the bullets. They were flying, okay. And guess what? None of them hit me. So everything's fine, you know.
Right.
But it's one of those deals, you concentrate on your mission to get the guys because they needed it. They were stuck. They had no way of getting their own supplies unless you brought it to them,
mm-hmm.
you know. So they were the number one priority. The bullets flying were, yeah, that was a nuisance. No, I hope I don't get hit, you know. But you just sort of, I put that in the back of my mind, just let it go. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess that would make sense. If you focus on those other things, it's hard to get your primary mission accomplished. And it's not beneficial to anyone. Yeah. Well, I wonder if you might take me through, say, a typical day. I mean, obviously, there may not have been such a thing as a typical day. But take me through just a regular day of flying for you. What would a regular day encounter or involve?
Well, a regular day was, normally speaking, the combat assaults would come when they came, okay? But normally, our mission was, day to day, was just to go out and support the 3 Corps as whole. Okay, and there was a whole bunch of different advisors in these different divisions and stuff like this. One particular one that I had a tendency to fly for quite often was the 25th Arvin Division up in Duckwa.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an aviator on ground duty. He was a full colonel. He was the only one on ground duty, and he was their advisor.
Hmm.
And so I flew up there quite often and flew for him. And when I say him, that was for the division and through all the outposts that was part of the division's AO. And so we would haul people back and forth, you know, transfer them, whatever. We could haul civilians. I've hauled pigs, vegetable gardens, you name it. You know, just anything that's required to be done, you know, that's what we would do. And generally speaking, it would take off. You'd take off like 7 in the morning, something like that. And then you'd usually get home, be released from the people you were supporting between 4:30 and 5, generally speaking, in the afternoon. You just fly back to the house. But it was a myriad of things. You could be hauling mail. I would take the colonel into Saigon and wait on him for when he had briefings and stuff like this to attend. So it could be just about anything that they wanted. That's what you did.
Mm-hmm. What was your relationship like with this colonel? Did he ask for you specifically, or were you just dispatched to him because you were the one they had up that day?
Well, it was just the luck of the draw, per se. He didn't ever ask for me, but I had an extremely good relationship with him because you got to remember, this guy was a bird colonel. He's an 06. You know, I'm a W1, and I'm way down the totem pole, like about 10 grades below him. But him being an aviator knew that when I flew in, and this is when I was an AC, okay, mm-hmm. aircraft commander, that the aircraft, it belonged to me, you know, not to him. He could tell me what he wanted me to do, but he couldn't tell me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that. And so we had a very, very good relationship, and what he would do, he had to fly 4 hours a month to get his flight pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some reason, when I'd go up there, he'd always fly with me. I would take the co-pilot, he would go back in the back and smoke cigarettes or read a book or whatever, and I'd put him in the right seat, and we'd go flying. And I distinctly remember one time we were out flying, and he was landing an aircraft. He landed the aircraft, and he bounced it in. It was not a pretty sight, you know? And I remember looking over at him, and I just told him, just matter of fact, I said, "Sir, I said, that was the shittiest landing I've seen lately. I said, if you do that again and hurt my airplane, I said, I'm going to throw you out. You are not flying with me again." And he looked at me and said, "Yes, Chief." And that was it.
Huh.
He was an excellent officer because he knew I was right.
Yeah.
He pranged it in. He hurt the airplane. He was never flying with me again.
I'll be darned. Well, that probably goes a long way to build your respect for the individual, too, I would think.
Sorry?
I would think that would go a long way to help building your respect for him.
Oh yeah, he was a man who demanded respect, you know, and he didn't have to demand it from you; just he automatically got it.
Yeah.
I don't know. He could have been a West Point officer. I don't know how, you know, his background. He was a very, very good officer.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pleasure flying for him, working with him.
Do you remember his name, perchance?
No, I don't. I've often thought of him. He's in the part of my brain that has good memories, you know. But I wished I could remember his name, but I don't. But anyway.
Right. All right. Well, we were talking about a typical day. You say you would fly till, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock and then be released for the day. What would take place once you're back at the base?
Well, we just come back in and the crew chief would do his thing to the aircraft, and the gunner would do his things to the ammunition machine guns. The co-pilot and I, or me and the AC, whichever the case may be, we go into operations, fill out our post-flight paperwork, logbook, and all the rest of that stuff, and then we just jump in we just jump on the deuce and a half, and they'd take us back to BOQ.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. We'd sit down and have dinner and maybe watch a movie or drink a little beer or something. So.
Right, right. Now, during this downtime when you're not on duty, what sort of things do you talk about with these other guys? I know you talked about probably staying more with other pilots and things like that, but what sort of things would you guys talk about when you had the time?
Oh, it's a myriad of things. We didn't talk that much about missions and stuff like this, unless something funny happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it was just news from home, you know, who's doing what to whom, how often, you know.
Right.
Just a myriad of subjects.
Sure. You mentioned you wouldn't talk about things typically on a mission or about a mission unless something funny happened. Were there instances that stick out in your mind as being pretty humorous?
Well, yes and no. Most of them we concocted ourselves, you know. But I had a little humor but usually it was at the expense of someone else, so I shan't get into that. But.
Right.
I will say this one time. My roommate and I, Dunn, we were flying together, which is very rare. I think I did that maybe three times the whole year. Anyway, we were flying south of Saigon, and Benoit was to the northeast of Saigon, so we were coming around, and when you were going from the south of Saigon to the north, you had to get in, Thompson Newt's air traffic, and so what they would have us do is, generally speaking, just get down real low on the decks, you know, probably less than 200 feet, and just fly around that way. That way the F-4s, the jet traffic could come on in, they'd be above us, so we wouldn't interfere with them. But one day we were coming back in, and we called, and so we dropped on down. And as we was flying over the Delta that's right there in Saigon, we flew across, and there was this motorboat out there, and it had a skeeter on the back. And what made the skier come out so good was it was a blonde in a blue bikini, you know. Well, needless to say, that got our attention. So, anyway, Don was flying. He was about half eighth anyway. We went over. He came and he said, we got to take a look at that. So anyway, he gets on down, and she waves. I believe she waved at us, you know. And so what he did was this. I forget the conversation. But anyway, what he did was this. He went over, and we saw where the boat was going, because they had mango marshes and stuff like this out there, and they were going in between them. And so we saw where he was going. So Dunn goes over and takes this Huey, and he puts it in the river. Well, when we put it in the river, he puts the skids in the river, and the Huey is taking up the entire, just about the entire width of the river at that particular point. So anyway, the guy had no choice but to throttle the boat back, and she sank in the back. So he picks up the aircraft, goes over where she is, puts the aircraft back down the water, and a crew chief, I think it was a crew chief on his side, motioned to her to come on in if she wanted a ride. And she said, yeah. So she came on in, and she got in, and she was sitting in the jump seat between he and I in the back. You know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we took her up and took her around, showed her Saigon and all the rest of that stuff. And I do not remember her name, okay? I barely remember her, what she looked like. But anyway, she was a very, very attractive young woman. Anyway, we came back and dropped her off at the where the boat was. He was still sitting there. Anyway, and so anyway, we flew back home. What made that sort of humorous was the fact that while we were airborne with this young woman, he came up and says, oh, what did she do? Well, it just so happens that she was the executive secretary to the ambassador of the United States.
Hmm.
And I told Don, we are dead meat. We're going to Leavenworth for the rest of our natural lives. Well, needless to say, she didn't say anything, because on the back of our helmets was our call signs. All she had to do was just look. You know. But anyway, we shared that. That was a little fun.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Right. Well, those things are good for morale and telling stories, things like that, which kind of leads me to another question I want to ask you, and that has to do with the morale, the attitude of the people that you saw there. What was the morale like in the 501st?
It was very good. It was very good when I was there with Major Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
It declined somewhat on the next commander, but when he was there, it was always good.
Yeah. What sort of things would go to create an environment of good morale?
Oh, it's just the camaraderie of doing things together. You know, it's like when we go on a combat assault, you had 12 or 13 aircraft that were sitting there in close formation, you know, and everybody depended on everybody else not to do something stupid,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you could crash very easily or intermesh rotor blades or do anything else. So everybody had to look out after everyone else, which we did. And that just builds a camaraderie where you trust people who you're flying with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's the biggie right there.
Yeah. You mentioned that morale took a bit of a hit once Major Henderson, I believe you said his name was, once he was gone. How long did you serve under him before he was rotated out?
It was about 6 months, I believe.
About 6 months. So he got there about the same time you did, probably.
No, he got there before.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah, they came in 64. But I believe it was there about 6 months or so. It could have been less. Kelly, I'm not all that familiar I can't remember that much.
Sure.
But I just remember it was a very, very cohesive outfit. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, what sort of things would bring the morale down? You mentioned that when you had another commander that the morale took a bit of a hit. What sort of things happened there?
Well, I'm going to beg off on that, Kelly.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
No.
I don't want to go down that road.
Sure.
Okay, if you don't mind.
No. That's no problem at all. No problem at all.
Okay, thank you.
Now, you've talked about the morale of your unit. What about the morale of others that you saw, whether it was Arvin morale or whether it was, say, for example, 173rd's morale? What were other people thinking about their part in the war at that time?
Well, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times, unfortunately for me, I never talked to anyone on the combat arms side of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Simple reason is, well, we just flew them in. Now, what I could tell you is that they would always get on the aircraft properly, do what they were supposed to do, offload us properly, blah, blah, blah. So I would assume that they were following orders extremely good. About their morale, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just never got a chance to sit down and talk with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right, right.
But I would assume it was very good because they were good troops.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about you? What were your thoughts on what you guys were doing there in Vietnam? Where you mentioned morale was high, but did you feel good about the work that you were doing there?
Well, it was one of those things, being 20 or 21 years old, okay? I just had a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what sometimes separates me from other Vietnam vets. I didn't have any animosity toward the Vietnamese, never had.
Mm-hmm.
Still don't, okay? It's the guys on the ground, the Kong, they were trying to kill me, and, you know, that was their job. Yeah. I was trying to kill them. That was my job.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kill each other for 8 hours a day and everybody go home and have a beer, you know. And I just didn't, I didn't really have any thoughts politically, militarily, or anything about the war or anything else. I was there to do a job and then go home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the way I looked at it.
Sure, sure. Now, when the public thinks about the Vietnam War, a variety of things come to mind, not always positive, and a couple of these things I want to touch on here. Now, early on, and you're here from 65 to 66, June 65 to June 66, what about race relations? Obviously, toward the end of the war, things begin to get a little muddied, and race relations aren't great in a lot of units. Did you see any sort of issues in terms of racial issues between blacks and whites, Hispanics, etc.?
None.
None.
No.
Mm-hmm.
We had an XO. His name was Major Wilson. He was a black guy. Willie, I forget Willie's last name. He was a W-3. He was one of our maintenance officers. He was black. I mean, I think they were just doing their job like all was.
Mm-hmm.
And on the enlisted side of the house, I never saw that either.
Yeah.
It's pretty, like I said, it was a pretty cohesive group, regardless of rank.
Mm-hmm. Well, another one of these topics that inevitably comes up is the issue of drug use. You're there pretty early on. Did you see any evidence of GIs or anyone using drugs, marijuana or otherwise?
None.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back, I would assume, to the issue of just good morale in a unit would be a big part of that. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, well, let's keep the morale train rolling here. One of the things, of course, that our services do for soldiers in the combat zone is often send them on an R&R, rest and relaxation period. Did you get a chance to go on R&R this first tour?
I had a chance. I didn't go.
Is that right? Explain that to me. Tell me about that.
Didn't need to. Didn't want to. You want me to expound a little bit, Kelly? It was just the war at that time, and it's like I said previously, you know, you go out and kill each other for 8 hours a day and everybody go home and have a beer.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't to the point, I don't think, from my viewpoint and from what I saw, stressful.
Mm-hmm.
Really super stressful. Now, all the rest of my guys, like Dunn, he went out, I think he went to Hong Kong or someplace, you know, but I just had no inkling to go, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't.
Interesting. Very interesting. As your tour begins to wind down here, and again, you leave in June of 1966, does that DeRose date, does that loom large for you in the future?
No, everybody had their DeRose calendars. You'd mark off your days and stuff getting down. And in our unit, it was like about a week or so before you DeRosed, you quit flying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was nice to quit flying. I didn't have to go downtown or do something else, you know. But
yeah.
It wasn't anything that it was nice to be able to look and say, well, I survived a year and I'm going home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that was about it.
Yeah. Do you remember what sort of duties you would have had during, say, this last week or so when you weren't flying?
Basically none.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you put your time in, take a little break or something.
Right, right.
And I actually think that was good. A lot of times some of the other guys, there was a Marine that I went to group with, VA in Fort Worth, and it was like 3 days before his DeRose date, he was still in the jungle and got blown up.
Oh, man.
You know, and that's how he went home.
Hmm.
Blown up. So, and it was a grenade or a something, booby trap or something got it, but it blew his, hurt his right leg really bad. So,
yeah.
He still has a very pronounced limp. So,
hmm.
So anyway, it was good. It was good, in fact, it lets you wind down. Okay, and get out of the battle mode, per se, and all the rest of that stuff. You can look forward to going home and act like a human.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting that you would say that. You say it give you a chance to act like a human, kind of reacquaint yourself and take you out of battle mode, to use your words. Did you find that you were anxious or uptight or just constantly on guard all the time while you're in this so-called battle mode?
No, I think everybody has. I don't think it's one of those things that you recognize.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's there. It's like, I know every time I'd walk downtown or something, everybody walking around, you had the potential to have knives, bombs, guns, or anything else. You know, they could be the cone.
Mm-hmm.
So you were constantly aware of your surroundings. You had to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But was it heightened to the point of being paranoia? No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Hmm. All right, now, tell me about the process by which you leave Vietnam. You have a week left. Tell me about going through the paperwork. Tell me about standing in the lines. Tell me about all the things you had to do to be processed out of Vietnam. Take me through that whole process.
Okay, this is where it gets really funny. You would think that I would remember a bunch of that stuff. I remembered nothing.
Is that right?
Nothing. Excuse me. The only thing I do remember is I flew on Continental Airlines coming back, and it was a flight for, Lord help, I don't know how long we were on that airplane. I remember that. I remember the stewardesses on the aircraft were extremely nice, and regardless of what you wanted, of course, they didn't have any beer or wine or anything like that on the plane, but if you needed anything, you got it, and I just, it didn't make any difference what rank you were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were a lowly PFC, or if you're a full colonel sitting in the front, you got the same treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do remember that. And I've often thought about those ladies on the airplane. And sometimes I wish I could find them and tell them how much I appreciate their efforts. But
yeah,
you know, that's impossible. So.
Sure, sure.
But anyway, I don't remember anything other than that. I can't remember landing at Travis. I can't remember getting on an airplane. But I do remember going to my brother's house in L.A.
Okay, tell me about that.
I flew from San Francisco, went down to Los Angeles, and stayed with him for just a couple of, I think, 2 or 3 days. And then he was going to drive me over to Tucson to the parents' house.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that. Now, when you start talking about, you were talking about the emotional feelings and, you know, anxiety and stuff like that. I must have been anxious, because I will share this with you, Kelly. When I came into Bob's house, I did not sleep until I hit Tucson.
Hmm.
It was about 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
I couldn't sleep. So when my brother is sleeping, I'm sitting in the kitchen reading the paper, reading a book, drinking coffee, doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't sleep. But once I got to my parents' house, I fell asleep on the couch and they couldn't wake me up.
Hmm.
So my dad had to carry me into the bed, put me in the bed, and I slept for about 24 hours.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, a lot of things would be at play there. Like you say, you're leaving a war zone, number one, where you had a heightened sense of awareness of your surroundings and things. And that just doesn't go away overnight, I wouldn't think. And there's an awful long flight from Vietnam back to the United States. That's going to wear on you physically, I would assume, as well. So probably a lot of things in play there. Hmm. Well, what was it like to be reunited with your parents?
It was nice to be home, you know, because I had a little brother and sister. And I'd missed their birthdays, and I got a chance to go over to Bergstrom Air Force Base, not Bergstrom, what is it, Davis-Monthan, over there in Tucson. And I bought each one of them a brand new bicycle for their for their birthdays that day. So I got to do that, you know, and stuff like this. But I also had somewhat of a revelation, Kelly, because I still think about it. And it really wasn't, but yet it was hurtful to some degree. Because I remember I was sitting there, and I was sitting at the table, drank a cup of coffee. My mother was sitting at the counter. I don't know if I told you this or not.
Mm-mm.
And she was looking out the window of the kitchen. And she put her hands on the counter, and I can still see her doing it. And she looked, and she asked me if I was her son.
Hmm.
I changed so much.
Is that right?
Yeah, I wasn't the same person. And the vets that I have talked to, every one of us agreed that whoever was that went to Vietnam is still there. They never came home.
Hmm. I wonder if you might expand on that for me. I've heard this from other people who have said this, very, very same or very similar thing. What sort of traits do you think you exhibited that would have led your mother to ask such a question?
I don't know.
Hmm.
She never talked about it or anything. She just said, "Are you my son?" And sort of threw me off guard.
Yeah.
But I did hear something, and I think this might have an insight. I was watching the net the other day, and this one guy, they were talking about the biography of Audie Murphy, you know, America's greatest hero. And one of his friends, or someone in the eulogy, said something like this, and I think this is pretty well close. I think it applies to everyone who's ever been in war. He said, at such a young age, he knew more about death than he knew about living.
Hmm.
And I think that probably hits it right on the head.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And obviously this was something that perhaps you didn't notice but was probably quite pronounced to your mother, having not seen you for a year. Then you come back with all of these experiences under your belt and all of the things that you saw. That makes perfect sense. Hmm.
Yeah, it's just like everybody, like I said, the Vietnam vets I talked to all say that young person that was over there died there.
Hmm.
They never came home.
Yeah.
Somebody else came home.
Right.
In a different in the same body, but there was somebody else there.
Hmm. You said this was somewhat hurtful to you that your mother would ask this. How did you react to her saying this?
I don't really remember, Kelly. I remember it jolted me, you know, like, huh? But we had a discussion after that, but don't ask me what it was. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember her asking me that question.
Yeah. Well, after you're there with your folks in Tucson, you still got some time left for Uncle Sam. What's the next step in your career there?
Well, at that particular time, we were coming home in 66. The war was really starting to ramp up pretty good, and flight school was right along with them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were assigning most everyone coming out of Vietnam, not to Germany or any place like this. They were assigned to Fort Rucker or to Fort Walters, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be instructed. And so I was not a lover of Fort Rucker, so I asked to go to Fort Walters, and that's where I went. Went to Fort Walters, and I became a primary helicopter instructor, and I did that for 2 years before I went back to Vietnam.
This very, very interesting. From your perspective as someone who flew in Vietnam for a year, now you're back training pilots to go to Vietnam and to fly. What was it like for you to teach these younger guys how to fly. What sort of insights did you provide? Tell me about the whole experience there at Fort Walters. I think this is very interesting.
Well, I went in, and because you come back and you flight school, the only thing flight school does for you, Kelly, it gives you a license to learn how to fly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the bottom line, and that's the truth. They give you enough to keep you basically safe. Basically, you won't kill yourself, hopefully, okay? But you really learn how to fly when you get out into a field environment. And when I always counted myself extremely fortunate that when I got out of flight school, I went to Vietnam. Because when I flew over 1,000 hours of combat time when I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of experience.
Yeah.
You know, guys prior to that, back in the 50s and stuff like this, they would take them years to get 1,000 hours of flight time. And I got it 1 year in a myriad of different scenarios. So, anyway, that's what I brought to the table to these guys. I wanted to make sure that they could do their basic maneuvers extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I tried to do, and I think I was on the most part successful.
So. Yeah. Had flight training at Fort Walters changed since the time you were going through it to what you were teaching?
Yeah, when I was at Fort Walters going through flight school, they had the one heliport, and it had like we had OH-23D models, and that's the only thing you flew in. They were your primary trainers. When I got back, we had TH-55s, and they started bringing OH-13s in, mm-hmm. and they started opening up other airports or other heliports around there, and new stage fields as well. And so I flew out of the main heliport for a little while, flying OH-23Ds, and they cranked up the new flights of TH-55s out at Downey Heliport that was adjacent to Mineral Wells Airport. And so I was transferred over there and started flying TH-55s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I flew those two aircraft the whole time I was there.
Yeah. What was the pace of life like at Fort Walters in 66, 67, 68 compared to when you were there in 65, 64, 65?
It was a heck of a lot different. They had barracks full of worn officer candidates and officers going through flight school. It was just quite busy.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it that way, okay? It used to be that we would run up to class and back and stuff like this, and they quit that because there was so much traffic anymore as you couldn't run, so they started busing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stuff like that. But the hectic pace increased pretty good.
Yeah. You mentioned that when you were a candidate there, you had trouble with someone who was, as you said, he was a screamer, and then he
yep.
was removed, and you had someone else who was taking the place that was a little bit more easy to deal with. What was your overall approach? What was your strategy or philosophy, if you will, of teaching these younger guys?
Never screamed at them, that's for dang sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would never belittle them. I would always try to be encouraging with them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, well, we screwed that up. Can you tell me what you did wrong? You know, and if they couldn't, then I would go back and tell them what they did wrong so they could finally understand what they were doing. You know, it's like I had a very proud moment one time when I was, if I can relate this.
Sure.
I was flying TH-55s, and TH-55 on an auto-rotation power off was like you had to be sort of mechanical to do it according to what the book said. And what I mean mechanical is you hit 25 feet, you throw the nose up, you get down to three, you yank up the collective, you know, and you let skids slap on the ground. And I always felt as though if the kids, most of them are older than I was, but anyway, if the students could feel what the aircraft was doing, then they could make the aircraft behave exactly the way they wanted it. But
mm-hmm.
you have to feel it. You can't just sit there and do mechanics on it. Because not mechanics work in a training in a precise scenario. Okay, you get outside those boundaries and it may or may not work. You understand?
Yeah, sure. Makes sense.
Okay. So what I had done is I had trained my students that at about 50 to 35, 50 feet, somewhere along there, just gradually raise, start bringing the nose up and feel the aircraft, what it's doing. And you will feel it decelerating, slowing down, okay, and stuff. And so I showed him, I told him, I said, feel what it's doing. And I said, it'll, you can feel how fast your vertical descent is and the blah, blah, blah. And I said, then we get up about 10 to 15 feet somewhere like in there, and I'd have them just start raising the collective just real easy, as much as they needed to, just start slowing down the descent even further, so that when the aircraft got down really close to the ground, like 6 inches or so, she basically almost stopped, okay, and she would just settle to the ground. Well, I would always get feedback on their last check ride, okay, and the highest score that you could get on any particular maneuver was double A's. And all of my students, they would go through on auto rotations, whether 180 degree, hovering, or a straight in, okay, they all got double A's. And so I had a stand ride. I had to go over to the standards branch, and there was a SPHE in there. And I had to take a standardization ride to make sure that I was teaching in accordance with the syllabus. So we went out, and he was a nice guy. So anyway, we got out to TH-55, and I shot an approach, and I was going through my MOI, or method of instruction, basically talking through it. And I got, then he said, okay, well, shoot me an auto rotation. I said, okay. So before I took off, I told him, I said, well, now, I don't teach it exactly the way the book says. And he had commented previously to us ever flying. He said, I see all your students get double A's on your auto rotation. You know, he had made a note of that. So when he said, well, okay. He said, well, tell me about it. So as I'm going around the traffic pattern, I'm telling him how I taught an auto rotation. Well, anyway, we come back around, and I cut the power and start my auto rotation. I'm talking to him the whole time. And I get down, and I pull the nose up and everything else, come down, and I pull in collected, get things stopped. And Kelly, when she hit the tarmac there, you couldn't feel it. It hit that soft, just fell down. And he looked at me and says, can you do that again? I said, I can try. Same thing. Just poof.
Yeah.
They changed the syllabus.
Is that right?
Yeah.
To the way that you were doing it?
The way I taught it.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, I thought that was neat.
Yeah, you must have felt very proud about that.
Well, I'm not much proud. I was just happy that somebody listened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many times you get so immersed in one particular scenario or whatever, it's the thought of change is, no, you can't do that.
Sure.
You know. But this guy did, and even though they brought it up, because I guess the proof was in the pudding.
Mm-hmm.
All of my students are showing double A's.
Yeah.
You know. So.
You mentioned this gentleman was a civilian. How many civilians were there there? I mean, you said that you were instructed by civilians, I believe, exclusively when you were there. Were there more?
Well, they still had, I guess, the basic structure of the civilian IPs. You know, they still had them there in a large number.
Mm-hmm.
How many, I couldn't tell you, but those folks were augmented with people like me, military IPs.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had military stand pilots as well.
Which would stand to reason. You have more people coming back with this experience. They can add, like you did on the auto rotation, add little bits and pieces throughout. It would be a lot more practical, I would think, education there, or training there, as it were.
Well, yeah, you had to improvise so many times. You know, it's like when you go into a mountain area, like we had to do every once in a while. There was one out there called Nui Ba Den. It was like a temple on a bull's butt. Okay, it set out there in three core, and there was this mountain out there, poof, out of nowhere. Basically, it was flat land until you hit there. And I think it was about 3,000 foot high, something like that. And right on the top, they had a little radio relay station. And the pad was just about big enough that you could, a little bit bigger than what the skids on a Huey. Okay, and that's what you had to shoot to. Chinooks would resupply them, but they would put their back wheels on the pad, drop the gate, and their front end is hanging over the edge, okay, flying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how small this thing was. And sometimes a steep approach is not going to work going up there. You know, so you had to use your own experience, savvy, Savvy, Moxie, whatever you want to call it, to make sure that you could get the aircraft up there and do your mission and, yep, be safe while you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what most military pilots are bringing back with them when they get Fort Rucker or Fort Walton. So.
Right. Tell me about your students. Were these a group of guys who were anxious and ready to go? Are they apprehensive about what they're doing? Tell me about your students.
They were just average students. I mean, they wanted to complete the course of instruction, you know, and get their wings and stuff. That was their, I don't think they really concerned too much about Vietnam. In fact, I don't remember ever talking to them too much about Vietnam. I probably did,
mm-hmm.
but I don't remember too much about it.
Yeah.
But they were just anxious to get their wings, you know, and accomplish being able to fly, and that's a good accomplishment. That's something we're proud of.
Oh, sure. You mentioned Vietnam. You're here for a couple of years. Are you keeping up with what's going on in Vietnam at all through the news or through Scuttlebutt or for returning pilots?
Uncle Wally's always on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're still getting most of your stuff from the, say, the CBS News with Cronkite or whoever?
Yeah. I remember seeing Uncle Wally and his famous editorial about Vietnam. I remember that.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, was in response to the Tet Offensive 1968, and you're still, I guess, at Fort Walters when this takes place. What did you hear about the Tet Offensive?
Oh, just what I saw on TV. You know, mm-hmm. they were sitting there. I saw some of the news media coming back and forth, you know, and certain snippets of videos and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I knew what the areas they were talking about because I'd flown my first tour. I'd flown so much up and down that coast and the inland of Vietnam. So I knew where they were fighting and all the rest of that neat stuff, where they hit. So,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't think too much about it. Just another day in Vietnam.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, tell me about what's going on for you personally during this time. You're one tour Vietnam veteran at this time. You're back at Fort Walters, back somewhat in your old stomping grounds of Texas, at least. What was going on with Archie Pitts outside of the military?
Oh, nothing. Mm-hmm. Drinking beer, chasing women, yeah, you know.
Right.
The standard old stuff, mm-hmm. you know. It's like, at one particular point, that was a particular point in my life that I could go anywhere that it was American Airlines base and find a date.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that many stewardesses. So, so anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just it. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, you're there for a couple of years, so you put a lot of pilots through Fort Walters.
Yeah, several.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You go back again in, I guess it's what, May of 1968. Is this something that you volunteered for? Was there just a need? Were you assigned to it? How did this all take place that you get orders for Vietnam again?
Yeah, I was supposed to got out in May of 68 because I'd had my 4 years in.
Mm-hmm.
But I volunteered a year, and I volunteered to go back to Vietnam. And I know why I did. It was something that happened in my first tour. There was, I won't get into this too much, but there was what I had believed. What I thought was there was a person who took one of my missions, okay, that I was supposed to be flying, and because they couldn't find me, okay, there's a long story behind that. Anyway, he got killed on that mission, and he was married, and I think he left three or four children, and that always bothered me, and I distinctly remember saying to myself, well, if I go back, maybe a married man won't have to. So, it's a bunch of guilt complex in it.
That's really, really interesting that would be the case. And you just flat out asked to go back then?
I'm sorry?
You flat out just asked to go back to Vietnam then?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were ready to gobble you up, someone with all of your experience.
Oh, yeah. We got another sucker on the line.
All right, well, you're still single now. You're volunteering to go back to this war, and the war's changed somewhat, at least in the public's perception of the war. The war has changed from 66 to 68. Again, you still have a family. You have a mother and father and brother, sister, and all of this. What was their reaction to your decision to go back?
Oh, I don't remember too much about it. I'm sure that my mother was very distraught about it. But my dad was, like I said, he was in World War II. And he didn't think too much about it. He didn't say anything, you know, to me that I remember.
Yeah. Okay, take me through the process by which you get back to Vietnam. This is in May of 1968.
Well, I took my leave, of course. I actually went to, I had been flying Hueys. And prior to going back to Vietnam, I went to Cobra Transition at Savannah Beach, Georgia.
Now, did you volunteer for the gunships?
Yeah. And so, anyway, I volunteered to fly Cobras, and so they sent me over to school, so I transitioned into those. And then I went back to Vietnam.
Well, let me stop you there, Mr. Pitts.
Sure.
Tell me about the transition to the Cobra. This is a whole different bird, and with a whole different mission.
Yeah, it was one of those things that it just popped in my head that I thought I would do that, you know. It was sort of interesting because I've been flying TH-55s, and if you look at them on the screen on the computer, they're little bitty aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They're really small. And then I get in this Cobra, I have to look at it, and I'm going, holy schmoly, pretty good size, you know. So, anyway, I transitioned into it, and went through gunnery with it, and shooting rockets, and all the rest of that stuff. But I just thought if I went back in, I could fly Hueys, but I said I might as well go back in an advanced aircraft. So I chose the Cobra over at Chinook. So I could have gone to either one.
Yeah. Tell me about the flying characteristics of the Cobra as opposed to the Huey.
Well, the Cobra was it's more streamlined. It's like, I forget what it is. The cockpit was like 4 foot wide or something like this. You could take on somebody, you know, nose into them, and it really reduced the amount of target that you gave them. It would fly much faster. You could cruise at 120 knots or so, you know, on good days. Weighted down with it, with ammo and stuff. You know, and the Huey would cruise at 80. It was more maneuverable. You could do basically a split S in it. Basically, that's all it is taking one and turning it upside down for a very short period of time, flying out the bottom. You could do those with it. You had to do those because it was a quick return on target. It was a maneuver you could pull. But anyway, it was just more maneuverable. You could do so much more with it. It was faster. It carried considerably more ammunition than a regular Charlie model gunship could do. You know, it's like our normal complement was we'd have 4,000 to 8,000 rounds of minigun ammo in the front, and then I would have like 76 rockets. And that was a lot. And your normal hog configuration on a Charlie model was 48 rockets with no guns. You know, so you can see the difference in how much firepower you could out. Had at your disposal. So that was the biggie of it. So.
Now you're also going to have to go through weapons training on this thing. What was that like?
Well, that's something you sort of have to get used to. Each one of these aircraft fires differently because it all depends on how the pods are set and a bunch of other stuff. But I'd never shot a rocket before in my life. Needless to say, I was spraying everything on about 4 country acres, you know. But after a while, it's like anything else, like I told you about flight school, the transition of the gunnery portion just gave you enough information to go out and train yourself in the environment that hopefully, like, blew blazed and killed somebody while you were doing it. So it wasn't very long, best my memory serves me, you know, the weapons phase. The total transition was 4 weeks. So you can see you don't have a bunch of time to do almost anything.
And where was this transition taking place?
It was at Fort. It was at Fort Stewart, Savannah Beach.
Okay. So, is it safe to say that you?
Yeah, Georgia. Yeah.
Did you enjoy the Cobra?
Did I enjoy the Cobra?
Yeah.
No.
Is that right?
No. I never did feel comfortable in it. In a Huey, the difference was in the Huey, I could. The rotor head had to come off. The tail boom had to come off. Something just had to be so catastrophic that I couldn't control. Otherwise, I would make it down fine. I had that much confidence in the aircraft. Cobra, I just never got that confidence into. But I've got like over 1,000 hours in it.
Right.
But I just never felt all that confident flying it.
Yeah. So you're through with Cobra transition. You're getting ready to head back to Vietnam. Now, before I get you back to Vietnam again, one of the questions that I forgot to ask you earlier that I wanted to ask now, this is 1968. The anti-war protests are getting louder by the day, more numerous by the day. We've got all kinds of changes in American society and American culture and political issues. And of course, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in April of 1968. All of this is taking place. What do you recall about the social, political environment while you were back in the States for these couple of years?
Well, remember, I'm sitting over here in Texas, okay? I lived in Fort Worth, and I was flying out of Fort Walters or Mineral Wells. And Texas, being the conservative state that it is, I didn't get hardly any of that here.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a bunch of stuff going on in San Francisco and some of the larger metropolitan areas on the East and West Coast via the television and the news, but I just didn't see anything around here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, TCE wasn't going nuts. SMU wasn't going nuts.
Right.
You know, so I was not exposed to it on a direct basis.
Hey, you saw these things taking place on the news. What was your opinion of all this?
I thought they were a bunch of jerks.
Hmm.
You know, I didn't know what their impetus was for acting like a bunch of yahoos, because what they were doing, and I still don't, Kelly, for the simple reason is they were sitting down there harassing soldiers for going to Vietnam because their country told them to,
mm-hmm.
instead of harassing the stupid Congress and the damn president who sent them.
Mm-hmm.
I never will forget that, and I'm going, you people are so damn stupid, you know. But anyway, I thought what they were doing, they were self-serving for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that stands to reason, too. It certainly does. All right. Now, you're finished with your transition to Cobras. You're volunteered for Vietnam. Take me back to Vietnam. What are the steps involved there?
Well, when I went back in, I flew into Tonsnut, and I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division. And they were at Tom K up in 2 Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So I got on a C-130. That's my memory serves me. And flew up to On K, and I stayed there for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. Could have been longer. Waiting to go up to their base in Camp Evans, which was in I Corps. And to show you how close we were to the DMZ, we'd sit on the bunkers at night and watch all the tracers and missiles going up for the guys flying up there with F-4s.
Hmm.
That's how close we were. But anyway, I was waiting to go up there because the Tet offensive had hit, and what they had done is they'd blown up the ammunition dump there at Camp Evans, which was the headquarters for the 1st Camp. And they had bombs and stuff all over the LZ, shrapnel on the runway, just everything. And they were trying to clean that mess up before they let anybody else come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they got that cleaned up, then I came in, and then I was assigned to second of the 20th Field Artillery, which is an aerial rocket artillery, which no longer exists. But I was assigned to battalion, and I was further assigned to Charlie Battery, which was there at Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And they had Alpha Battery, Bravo Battery. They were two other places, and they had Delta Battery, which is a or Echo Battery, one or two, I forget which one it was. But it was like an administrative flight,
mm-hmm.
for the battalion.
Right.
But anyway, I was assigned to those guys right there at Camp F.
Now, the 2nd of the 20th Field Artillery, is this exclusively Cobras, or are there still some Huey gunships in there?
Yeah, they're infusing Cobras into it. That's why I was assigned there. They said they need all the Cobra jocks coming in the country, need to go to the 1st Cab because they were using the Cobras in. And while I was there, I flew B model gunships, flew Charlie models, flew Cobras after we got all those in.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
Okay, now tell me what it was like to come into this new outfit in this new part of the country. Yes, you'd served in the Delta, but there's, as we all know, there's a whole different war, different characteristics of the war in the Delta in 65 and 66 as opposed to what's going on up north in 68 and 69. And of course, now you're with an aerial rocket artillery outfit. What was it like coming back into this unit? I mean, yeah, yes, you had this experience, but this is also going to be very new for you in a lot of ways. Tell me about transitioning into this new unit.
Well, the first thing they did when you got assigned there is they put you in a holding area to some degree, I guess it was, and then they gave you this little orientation. I forget how many days it was, like 2 or 3 days. It could have been longer, you know. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you this, though. The coast, and it was Camp Evans, sit on the coast of Vietnam, the northern portion of South Vietnam. You can say anything you want to about the coast being cool. I remember sitting on a hill, and the sergeant who was up there, who was instructing and stuff, and he said, well, guys, he said, today is not too bad. He said, it's only 117. That's true. And you, darn hell, it was hot, you know. But anyway, we went through that, then I got settled into my unit, and then the first thing I did, of course, they go out, they give you a stand ride, so and see how well you shoot, blah, blah, blah. And I was assigned to First Lieutenant. So.
Did you know anyone in this unit?
Huh?
Did you know anyone in this unit?
Zero.
Zero. Tell me about the people. What were they like? What was their morale like? Who were these guys?
These people are just, they're a little bit different, and I can tell you why. I lived in a tent that until we was almost about ready to leave Camp Evans, did not have any sides to it. Okay, in other words, it was a tent with poles and stuff. It didn't have like a preformed floor on it and stuff like this. So we lived in tents. We had cots. We had mosquito nets. And if you had any part exposed to that mosquito net, you'd wake up with multiple holes in you. It was hot. You had an air mattress. Couldn't sleep on it because it was rubber, and you'd wake up in the night several times and have to wring your sheets out because it'd be so wet.
Mm-hmm.
So you just slept on the cot itself or maybe a blanket or something along those lines. And the life was basically sort of miserable. You know, you couldn't get any relief from the heat. The water, there was no ice provided to you because they didn't have that stuff. And it was just considerably different than what I did. Had my first trip. Go back home to the BOQ, you sit down and have a cold beer, you shoot the bull with the guys, take a fresh shower, blah, blah, blah. And now I went from that to basically living on the rough side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was more like being in the field per se than it was being in garrison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think it was just sort of tough on the guys. To this day, when they have a reunion, they quit having reunions because nobody show up.
Huh.
It was just, it's one of those memories that you have a tendency you want to flush.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And some of them, I remember there was a guy in my platoon that always lived in the back of the tent. And I don't remember what he looked like.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's how few times I ever saw him. He was a basic hermit in the back. So, it's just strange.
Yeah.
Just different.
Yeah. Well, tell me what...
It was stressful because we would get... Back my first tour, we didn't have to worry about rockets coming in or anything else, but we used to get rocketed. Not a whole bunch, but enough to keep you on your toes. So.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about being rocketed. What's that like for you? This is a pretty new experience.
Oh, well, up there at Camp Evans, none of them really got really close to us. The guys, they're usually across the runway or somewhere outside. I'd hear them explode, of course, you know, but they were just never on our side. We were on somewhat further, we were pretty far away from the central area, and that's what they aimed for because that's where the runway was and the headquarters and all the rest of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we were somewhat distant from it, but, you know, you'd hear them coming in, you'd hear them blow up, you'd hear the sirens going on, and all the rest of that neat stuff. But it wasn't scary, per se. you know, because they were, you just hear a boom, but it was come some distance off. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is obviously a much more rugged existence, I guess, is one way to put it. What is going to be the mission of the of your new outfit of the to the 20th?
Well, we were artillery is a combat arm that supports the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's exactly what we did, except now we're the aerial arm of artillery instead of being a fixed tube on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so we flew just like the artillery would be. We'd be given directions and stuff. We would get a fire mission that would come down through battalion or divardy division artillery from infantry units on the ground who were in contact, and we would go out and support them with direct fires on the enemy. And that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
We shot for them, and we would listen to the FO, forward observer, and he would tell us where to shoot.
This is
that's all we did. We supported the infantry.
This is a considerably different approach to the war than what you had seen earlier in your first tour.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, take me through a typical day here. You're supporting the infantry on the ground with aerial artillery. Take me through a typical day here.
Well, the day would always start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they had three crews, red, yellow, and blue, I think it was. Colors. But the red crew was what they called the hot crew. And what you would do is that there was, and the crew was two aircraft. You always flew two of them in pairs. And so this pair would go up, when a mission would come down, this pair would take off. Now, what made this sort of unique too is regardless of where you were at the time that the mission came down, and it was relayed to you by a diesel horn that was hooked up to a 3,000 psi bottle, oxygen bottle.
Mm-hmm.
That thing would rattle the dead. But anyway, they would blow that off, and then you had, from the time he hit that button, you had 2 minutes to be airborne. And I don't know if you know anything about aircraft or something, but that's asking a lot.
Yeah, that's very, very fast. So everything had
sure.
to be prepared, pre-flighted. Everything has to be ready to go.
Yeah, what you did was this. You pre-fly the aircraft. The blade was tied over next to the burn. The only thing you had to do is hit the blade and the tie down would come off of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then the controls were all set. The master switch was the only thing was not on. The fuel was on. The throttle was set. Everything was set. The only thing you had to do was hit the starter. Hit the master switch and starter button to crank it up. And the scenario went like this. When the bell went off, or the buzzer went off, pilot would jump in the back, and the first thing he did was strap himself in, put on his helmet, turn the radios on, and get communications with operations. Okay. While he is doing all of this, the gunner up in the front has got the master switch on, and he's cranking the aircraft.
Okay.
He's not even tied in yet. He gets the aircraft up to fly at idle. Okay. By that time, the guy in the back has got his seat belts on, shoulder harness, and all the rest of that stuff, helmet on, the radio's on, everything else. Then I, being in the back, then what I would do is I'd take over the throttle, advance it up to full flight RPM, engage everything I had to engage, and I'd start backing out, and he still doesn't have his stuff on.
Hmm.
But you could do it. And then once he had his, all of his equipment on, then he would get on the radio and contact operations and find out where we were going and what we were doing, and he's writing all this stuff down while I'm taking off and blasting off through the wild blue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty quick operation.
Yeah, the best I ever did was 54 seconds.
Is that right? My goodness.
Kelly, I was the co-pilot and I were both standing next to the airplane.
Mm. Nonetheless, that's still pretty rapid.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So your gunner, the guy in the front, is talking to operations. He's writing this stuff down. You've got the aircraft in the air. Where do we go from here?
Well, we would take off and go. I'm just going to give you a regular support mission.
Okay.
We'd go out and we'd have the contact information, who we're supposed to, and the coordinates. So we'd blast out the coordinates, and then I would be talking to the guy on the ground as I was getting out there to find out what the actual situation is, you know, what he's facing, and what kind of intensive fire, what kind of fire he's getting, blah, blah, blah. So when I'd get out there, I'd tell the guys to mark their lines, and what they would do is they would pop smoke on one side and the other side to mark their lines, and that would give you a straight line that they were in,
mm-hmm.
most oftentimes, okay? And then sometimes Charlie, who was on your radio frequency, he would pop smoke too, so you'd have to get that squared away. You know, if you're doing white, green, red, you know, who's the good guys, who's the bad guy?
Mm-hmm. And there's so always
a... He established where the good guys were, then he would tell me a certain distance to shoot, he would tell me where the enemy was, and then I would begin shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't go through and just launch 76 rockets in one whack.
Right.
You know, you go through and probably pop a couple of pairs, and you would spread them down the line, and that would give you multiple passes. So if you missed the first time, you could just keep hitting the enemy, you know, with multiple passes between you and the other aircraft. And we would do that until the enemy disengaged or they had been quieted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the two. But we were in constant contact with the FO, or the forward observer down there.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell us where to go, shift fires, or whatever. So,
now
that was basically it, Kelly. It was the one thing that shooting for the infantry would get to you is you had to be, and I'm not bragging, everybody could do this, you had to be good at what you did on the rockets because they'd have you shoot so close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is the Kong learned, the Vietnamese learned very early on, the closer you get to the American troops, the safer you are.
Mm-hmm.
Simple reason is you can't drop a 250-pound bomb 30 feet from them.
Right.
So you have to, the danger close is way on out for bombs, 8 inches, 105 artillery, and everything else. But for our rockets, even though they were very, very deadly, but they were like 10 and 17-pound warheads. So they would spread out. They would the shrapnel was quite extensive from each head, but you could shoot closer. And it was not uncommon to shoot 10 meters. That's 30 feet from them.
Hmm. Yeah, that's incredible. And these are 2.75-inch rockets, correct?
Right.
Right. And, of course, what do you have? What is on the Cobra? Is it a 30-millimeter minigun up front?
No, it was a 7.62.
A 7.62, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Except on mine, I got rid of the chunker. Most of them came with a 40-millimeter grenade launcher,
mm-hmm.
and minigun. Well, I hate the grenade launcher. I couldn't hit a bull in the butt with a bass fiddle, that thing. So I had Chubby, was our armament guy, and I had him swap that out for another minigun. So I had twin minis carrying 8,000 rounds of ammo.
Wow.
That could do some rocking and rolling.
Yeah, I would guess so. Hmm. Now, are you ever called in to just strafe with the miniguns up front?
Well, you did what you had to do. I'd use those quite often when you run out of rockets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had an override switch in the armament system that if you're firing rockets, you're not going to shoot the minigun.
Mm-hmm.
It just won't allow you to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, because you could actually... If the gun turned one way, the rocket's going to make it explode right there, right in front of you.
Right.
So they had that safety switch on that. So if I was shooting rockets, you couldn't shoot miniguns. But if you shoot miniguns, you could shoot rockets,
mm-hmm.
you know, back and forth. But you could use them, yeah. I remember one mission that Bernie Condred and I, he was flying the other aircraft, and my guns didn't work for some reason. I think they were jammed up or something. I forget what it was. Anyway, there was a guy shooting at a forward air controller, an L-19, and he took the minigun. His gunner took the minigun and cut the top out of a tree with it.
Hmm.
And the guy came out in pieces.
Wow.
He just chewed him up with a thing. So, yeah, you did what you had to do.
Yeah. So for someone who's not familiar with how this would work, who is controlling the rockets and who's controlling the minigun?
Minigun is, the guy in the front, it has primary use of the minigun, okay? It'll turn, I think it's 270 degrees. It goes X number of degrees up and X number of degrees down. so he can shoot to the side. He can shoot like 90 degrees out if he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and stuff like that. He can shoot rockets. He can, but he has to take. He has to use a pilot override switch to do it.
Okay.
He can, but you get in the back. It's not as accurate. Don't ask me why. I've never been able to shoot one out. Shoot worth a dang out of the front seat. But in the back, the pilot can shoot the mini guns, but they are in a fixed stowed position. They only shoot forward.
Hmm.
He can't make them turn one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The pilots of the Apache now, either one of them can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all they have to do is look somewhere, look over and see where they want to fire and hit the button. You know. So, but we didn't do that. But anyway, that's. And primary responsibility for rockets was the guy at the back. Primary responsibility for the guns were in the front.
Sure. Okay. I wanted to make that clear for anyone who is not familiar with the Cobra.
Sure.
Just how that would work. Okay. Now you are out there supporting the infantry. You're firing rockets off. How long could you stay on station?
It all depends on the how bad the contact was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it would. Sometimes it was just sort of horrendous. By the time you got out there and figured out what was going on, a lot of times I had one of us, either the guy in the front or myself, would contact the back there and tell them, launch another crew. We're going to run out.
Hmm.
You know? And a lot of times what they would do is the operations would go ahead and launch another crew and then call DeVarley and tell them we were launching another one because the current situation of the field.
Yeah.
You know, and they had the authority to do so. So we could give these guys, like, coverage, and when we ran out, hopefully the next guys would be there to just take over where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
You know. There was a lot of times that we had, like, just round robins. You'd go back in. If you were the hot crew, go back in, reload, get ready to go again. You know, and have to turn right around and go back out the same AO.
Mm-hmm.
And it all depends on the mission itself. And each one of them is different. Sometimes we can go in and make two or three passes or something, and then the FO would say, he'd key the mic and you'd hear nothing going out, nothing coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So the contact was broken.
Right.
You know. Other times you'd sit there and you'd use all 76, mini guns, rocks, bow and arrows, anything else you had available to you, you know, to support the guys in the field, because you could hear the guys when you'd pull the mic. To talk to you, there's a distinct difference between an AK-47 round and a 16. You could hear the difference in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I could hear the 47s coming in. You could hear them going off. So.
Yeah. What kind of weaponry did the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese that you're facing at this point? What kind of weaponry did they have in addition to the AKs that you were concerned about? The obvious answer is all of them, of course. But what sort of things would stand out in your mind?
The biggest one was 51 cals.
Mm-hmm.
They were the same as our Molotovs, if they were 51s. And they were the anti-aircraft weapons. And they could reach out and touch you.
Yeah.
I think their tracer burnout was like 3,600 feet.
Hmm.
You know? Shoot almost a mile before the trace would even burn out.
Mm-hmm.
And the ball ammunition is going further than that. Not a problem.
Yeah.
You know, so you had to be very, very mindful of a 51. So that was the one that would always stood out. But I will say this, we were called on, AORA was called on, I don't know about battery, but for sure, was called on several times to take 51s out because we flew so high.
Mm-hmm.
You could actually fly much higher and shoot with just as good accuracy as the other guys because that's how we did it. And so you practice doing a scenario one way, you get pretty good at it after a while.
Yeah, sure.
We could get out there like 5,000 feet or something like this and take on a 51 and take them out. And yet, you know, you're still in danger. Now, don't get me wrong, but you minimize the risk.
Sure.
Because if a regular Cobra went in there, he's just dead meat.
Mm-hmm. Now, flying in support of or with the first cab, who is the enemy you're facing most often? Were you facing NVA? Were you facing
NVA?
VC is NVA at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because halfway through, I've got to tell you this, Kelly. Halfway through, I was up 2-core, halfway through it, almost exactly halfway, we moved to 3-core, back to my own stomping grounds on the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
And we, because of the NVA infiltration going into 3-core, they were concerned about the protection of Saigon. So they moved the first cab back down there, and so I started flying in 3-core again, like I did my first tour. But regardless of where we were at, of location, we face the same enemy, the NVA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at this time after the Tet Offensive, of course, the NVA are much more active. The VC have been really damaged by the outcome of the Tet Offensive, and the NVA presence was much more pronounced at this point, certainly in the war. And that takes me to another good question for you. How had the war changed? I mean, it had been 2 years since you had left. How had the war changed since you had been gone?
That's a good question, Gil. It was like night and day.
Explain that.
We're going to talk strictly armament now.
Okay.
When I was flying the first tour, you'd see an NVA every once in a while, quote unquote. I never saw any, but that's on the G2 and stuff. I guess coming in, intelligence coming in would say they would find an NVA with his cost, uniform on and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What we faced mostly was Viet Cong, and Viet Cong had worn out weapons in a gouge eye that couldn't see anything, and he would shoot, and his chance of hitting you was about 1 in 50 million, you know, literally. We had guys shooting me all over the place and never hit. When I come back the second time, you have regular NVA troops, and they turn around and they have AK-47s. They have 51s. They have those rocket-propelled grenades, RPGs. They have fairly sophisticated weapons. And guess what? They actually know how to shoot them. That's what's even worse, you know. So that's what I found. It's just night and day.
Yeah, much better equipped and much better trained than the VC. And a lot more of them than there would have been the first time around, of course.
That is correct.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the overall battalion, the second of the 20th Field Artillery. How was it arranged? How was it organized? Who was in command of this outfit when you came aboard?
Well, like I said before, we were a part of DeVardi, or Division Artillery Command, and they had Division Artillery had all the artillery assets within the division. I think there was 3 battalions of 105s or something like that, and I think we had a 155 battalion as well, and we were in there as well. And so they had that, and then we had our battalion headquarters, and don't ask me who the commander was, couldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had each one of the batteries. And each battery, there was 3 brigades, the 3 infantry brigades within the 1st Cavalry Division, and there was 3 ARA batteries, and each battery was assigned to a brigade. Alpha Battery was in 1st Brigade, Bravo Battery, 2nd Brigade. I was in Charlie Battery, and we supported 3rd Brigade, 1st Cav.
Mm-hmm.
And all those units associated there, too. But that's how it broke out.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly straightforward organization.
Yeah. Sure. Well, tell me about the 1st Cav. This is a pretty storied outfit from years past, and, of course, even during in the Vietnam War, the early stages of Vietnam, and throughout this period, what was it like being part of this unit?
They was a, like I said, it was a rugged, rough way to go. The average combat, average infantryman in World War II saw a combat of 40 days,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was interesting. You know, but they would be relieved from from on the lines and stuff, I guess, whereas the infantryman in Vietnam saw combat, Lord help, much more than that,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, but the 1st Cav was a butt-kicking outfit. They were. I read somewhere in Stars and Stripes magazine, a newspaper that was over there. A guy wrote in, and he said, who has the most confirmed kills? This unit, this unit, this unit, this unit. And the guy wrote back, and he said, you can take all the units you just ask, combine them, double it, and you cannot match the 1st Cav. And then they go on to say that 75% of the 1st Cav's body count came from one unit. it was the first of the ninth camp. And those were the guys who were, they were the scout outfit. They had little birds, H6s, and they had cobras. And they would go out seeking the enemy and taking them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had 75% of the killed. That's amazing.
Yeah. What was morale like in this unit? Was it different from other units that you'd seen?
Yeah, it was, like I said, everything was so rough and tough and everything else. The camaraderie wasn't all that good there. It had nothing to do with leadership, nothing. It was just because everything was rough. We were flying all the time. We had another mission that we had to fly, and it was called Mortar Patrol. We'd fly the Cobra flying all the hours of night, one Cobra above the LZ. And it was that, I hated that, you know.
What did that consist of?
Nothing, just get up there and fly around.
Hmm.
And you waited till if somebody was going to try to mortar you or launch rockets. The idea was if you could see the flash of the muzzle or the rocket trail, and they'd go back in and take out where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they got really smart about that because that happened to me just one time in that year. And they had a 75, and you could tell the 75 recoilless because the way it explodes, it gives out a different signature than a rocket or a mortar.
Mm-hmm.
You're good at this stuff after a while.
Sure.
They had a 75 on one side, and they had a mortar on the other. And when you're up there flying around, of course, you got your lights on. And so when I saw one hit, and I turned, you know, and nothing. I couldn't see anything. And then I saw another one hit, and I turned. It was a flash, and there was another one coming out of the mortar. So I turned that way. Stops. And so the 75 kicks in. So in other words, they had you going back and forth.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Well, that made sense. What I did is I would just reach up and shut off the lights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can hear you, but they can't see you. And so the mortaring and that stuff stopped. And that's what I wanted to do, just stop.
Mm-hmm.
And no one got hurt out of it. No damage, nothing. They just hit the unoccupied areas of the LZ. But anyway, they stopped. But it was also when they were doing it, it was pitch black. And that's what they learned real early on. That's what you do. Because when you have an overcast sky and there's no moon, there's no nothing, when you turn toward them, you see nothing, but there's a sea of black all the way from as far up as you can look to all the way down.
Hmm.
You can't see trees. You cannot see anything. It's black, solid black. And this flash would go off. You see the flash. Now, where did it go? You can't isolate the point where that flash was. You saw the flash, but you don't know where it is on the ground.
Yeah.
It's in that sea of black floating around out there somewhere. And so they got that down to a science, because when the moon's out and stuff like that, you can see for miles,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can isolate that flash because you can make out the topography around the flash and isolate and know exactly where that flash came from. And because what made it so difficult to shoot in that environment is that every LZ had ambushes out around the LZ, all the way around it.
Mm-hmm.
You had them marked on your map where the infantry was supposed to be, but sometimes they weren't exactly where they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be off a little bit. And so you had to be damn sure of where you were shooting, or you might hit your own troops. And that happened one time to a guy. So he did that.
That must be incredibly difficult to be flying. What altitude would you be at typically on one of these?
2,500, 3,000 feet.
Okay, so you're up there quite a ways then. But again, yeah. this utter sea of black, and you can't see anything. It must have been really, really difficult to be effective in this.
Well, yeah, that's why I never shot. It's like I told you, this one guy did. It was the same scenario going. He thought he had isolated the shot or where this mortar was shooting from. And he fired several rockets and hit right in the big middle of a bunch of American infantrymen.
Hmm.
You know, and that's why I wouldn't shoot, because I couldn't be sure where my rockets were going. I couldn't be sure where that mortar was. So, but when I shut the lights off, they stopped. So what am I trying to do? Get them to stop.
Yep, that's the whole point of being up there.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, why don't we stop there for today, Mr. Pitts?
I'm sorry, save my ears.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Archie Pitts. Today is 11 June 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Pitts is joining me by telephone again from his home in McKinney, Texas. Okay, Mr. Pitts, you were getting ready to relate a story about your second tour to me here right before we turned on the recorder. So can you go ahead and pick it up there, please?
Yes, like I was saying, there was an LZ firebase outside of Quan Loy, and don't ask me the name of it, I can't remember. But they were getting overrun. It was a night mission. And I went out there to fire for them. And you could actually see the Kong and everybody else running across the ground because they had a flare ship that was going around and illuminating the area very, very well, I might add. And I was talking to the FO on the ground. And he was directing my fires for me, and I was going outside the fence and stuff. I wouldn't dare shoot inside the LZ for fear of hitting one of our own troops, mm-hmm. you know. But I could shoot out around the fence and stuff. But anyway, he called me up and he said, Max, I need a favor. And I said, yeah, what you need? And he said, I need you to put a couple of pair of rockets on the bunker I'm in. Well, that doesn't sound right, does it?
Yeah.
And I said, what? And he said, yeah, he says, they're trying to get in. And so he told me where he was. I recognized that I saw the bunker where he was at. And what he had done is he had shut the door, barred it on the inside, and he had his prick 73 or whatever that radio was, the antenna sticking out of the slit in the door. You know, and that's how he was talking to me. So anyway, I identified where he was at, and I just told him, I said, well, I was shooting 17-pounders at the time. And they do put out a pretty good whomp when they go off. And I told him, I said, well, just make sure you get down. I said, I don't know if it's going to penetrate those sandbags you've got or not. So anyway, I did. I put two pair of four rockets on his bunker, and it was quiet. I couldn't get him for a while. And I think maybe it's because the concussion or whatever made him, he couldn't hear. But anyway, he finally got back on, and I said, you okay? He said, yeah. And he was quiet for a minute. He says, thanks, Max. He said, they're gone.
Huh.
I thought that was quite unusual. It's the first time I ever had an American FO tell me to shoot him.
You know? could you see the enemy in the bunkers?
No, they were on the outside somewhere. I didn't see them. Mm-hmm. I do remember the bunker. I can still see the bunker in my brain, you know. And I remember shooting it. Those two pair evidently got rid of the threat because he kept on talking to me, and we finished our mission and stuff. And there was other ARA sections coming out relieving me, you know. But they finally squelched the invasion, as it were. So
that's just absolutely incredible and brave and desperate. I mean, that brings up another good topic, I think. What about this idea or reality of bravery? What do you think makes someone brave? Is it out of desperation or necessity or people born with it? Where does this come from, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, my wife's a psychologist, and I'm sure she could even answer that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Kelly. I think, it's the best thing of bravery the definition I've ever heard was, and I think it's so appropriate, the question you asked, it's that ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that. If everyone, it's like Audie Murphy, okay? He was a short man. He wasn't a big man by any stretch of imagination or anything else. And look what he accomplished, you know? He saw the need, and he just did what he was having to do, what he wanted to do. So, you know, that's what I think it is. Just ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Yeah, and especially under those kinds of circumstances.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's just incredible.
Yeah. So
you mentioned that there's another moment or another event that you wanted to talk about here about in your second tour. What was that about?
Well, this was sort of sad. I was on another fire mission, and I'm supporting the infantry. I was talking to this FO on the ground, and it was a heavy firefight because you could hear when he keyed the mic, you could hear all the stuff going out, the stuff coming in. And I was sitting there talking to him, and then all of a sudden I couldn't get him anymore. And I kept calling him, because I didn't dare shoot unless he told me where to shoot, because I was afraid I would, you know, injure some of our own troops. So anyway, finally, it was after several minutes now. I don't know how long. To me, it felt like an eternity, but I'm sure it was less than 5 minutes. Somebody else got on the phone. It was a different voice, and I could barely understand him. And I told him, I said, what's going on? And what it was, this is the radioman for the FO, and he was crying. And he was not hysterical, but he didn't have a presence of mind at that particular time either.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was, between our talks of back and forth, the FO had his head blown off.
Mm.
Okay, and the radio man was there, and it took me, Kelly, I don't know how long it took me, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, I don't know, to get him to calm down, because this guy was artillery as well, and he could direct me just as well as the FO.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I finally got him calmed down good enough so he could direct where I was supposed to fire, you know, and then I finished the mission, and the Kong broke off at contact and left. But that was extremely challenging.
Yeah. So what do you say to this young man when he's seen this ghastly sight of his FO being killed right in front of his eyes? What do you say to a young man like this to try to calm him down and to move on?
Well, I can't remember my exact words, but it was something like, you know, we have a mission to do, and I wasn't screaming or hollering or anything else. I'm trying to be very calm. I said, we've got a mission to do. I said, you've got guys down there getting killed, like, you know. I said, we have to go ahead and support, get these rockets down there to help save some more lives. I said, you got to help me do this, you know. I said, I can't do it by myself. And so I just kept talking to him, and pretty soon he got online, and we got the mission done.
Hmm. What about you coming in from a mission? Before, when you were in the Hueys, it was one different mission, and now you're in such close support with contact troops and contact on the ground. What's it like when you're done with a particular mission, you come back, say, for the evening or afternoon or whenever it is? What do you do to unwind or to deal with a day of combat? What do you do?
Nothing. There was nothing to do.
Hmm.
Where I was at,
yeah,
at Camp Evans and at Quan Loy both, when you came home, what you had was, there was a tent that you had, and that was it. So you went back to the tent. If you were the hot crew, per se, then what you'd do, in fact, every time you went out, what the first thing you'd do is, after you shut the aircraft down in the berm, is help the crew chief take the rockets out of the rocket berm and reload the aircraft, get it about ready, get it to go again. So it's mission capable. And so you'd do that, and just waiting for the next mission to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way to unwind in there.
Yeah.
To show you the difference, you're sort of stuck. You know, like in Benoit, I wasn't. When I was with the ARA, I was stuck because there was a PX. It was like across the runway, a little bit further down, and I got to go in there one time in 6 months.
Hmm. Why only the one time?
Huh?
Why only the one time?
Because you're always on call or something.
Hmm. Okay.
You were constantly, you were under the gun regardless of what your status was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once I left and went on R&R, then I could, of course, you know.
Right. And the pace of missions there with the first cab was obviously really, really high. Does that take a toll on you to not be able to sit back and, you know, say, have a cold beer or talk to guys or get away or do something like that? Does that take a toll on you physically or mentally?
Yeah. Mentally, it does. It's like one of the side effects of all that crap was I don't remember names worth a dang. Mm. I don't see faces. I can see uniforms and stuff like this, but I do not remember faces or names.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like it's almost kind of like a bad dream.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is.
I don't know if that helps or not.
No, it certainly does. Is this something that you've kept with you over the years?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it stays with me. a bit of it. You can't put a bandage on your brain, so.
Right, right.
With it, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned R&R on the second tour. You chose not to go on R&R in your first tour.
That's correct.
But you did decide to go on R&R on the second tour. Was there a difference there on why you chose not to and then you chose to in the second tour?
Well, it's stress level. I wanted to get away. In fact, I had put in for R&R to go on my seventh month or eighth month, I think it was, eighth or ninth, something like that. And put it off because the more time that you had in country, the better selection you had for where you wanted to go. And I wanted to go to Australia. And so that was one of the hot avenues to go to. And so you had to have some time in country. And so when I put in for Australia, and I was going to get it. I had, I'd have 8 months or 9 months, whatever it was, in country. Well, prior to that, you could take a two-week leave. And I did that, or a week leave. And I went down to the R&R Center in Saigon to catch a flight out. And they said, where do you want to go? I said, I don't care. Somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just the first available seat. And of all things, the first available seat was to Australia. So I got to spend two separate weeks in Australia, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
You essentially had a two-week leave in Australia then?
Yeah, I had essentially had 1 week leave, okay? Then the R&R was another week.
Huh.
And that was different. I think I took my leave like 6 months, maybe 7 months, something like that, in country.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. So,
no. Tell me about this trip to Australia. Tell me about getting there. Tell me about the process of going through Australia and customs. Tell me about this time you spent there.
Well, I can't remember hardly anything.
Is that right?
I don't remember getting on the airplane. I do remember the guy coming in to the barracks that we were in, waiting to go. And he called my name, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've got a slot." I said, "Where's it going?" He said, "Australia." He said, "You want it?" I said, "I'm packing my bags." So I remember that. But other than that, I don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Except for flying, we flew across from Perth or Darwin up there at the top on the northwest corner down to across the continent and down to Sydney. And I remember in all that distance we flew, I saw one intersection. I never will forget that. It was just blank country.
It's pretty desolate in that part of the world.
Yeah, just one intersection across the whole continent. I thought that was very interesting. So.
Yeah, pretty
anyway,
open.
Anyway, got there and we went to the R&R Center and the guy told us that, don't do something stupid, So we went out and basically, if you want to know the truth, Kelly, what I did was basically for a week stay drunk.
Yeah. Well, are there any high points of this time that you were there in Australia?
No, can't remember too much of it.
Yeah. Now, you say you stayed drunk for a week, and I think that a lot of people would probably understand why that would be the case with the stress level and blowing off steam and a variety of things. But why do you think that you were, why do you think you chose to do this?
To do what? Get plastered?
Yeah, to get plastered for a week.
It was just stress, I think. It was just, I had to do something, And, I remembered I did, stayed drunk most of the time, but I did remember eating some good Australian food while I was there, blah, blah, blah. But other than that, I just basically stayed included.
Yeah. How were the Australians?
I'm sorry?
How were the Australians? How were you treated there?
Oh, nice. They're very good people.
Yeah.
I've often wanted to go back, because I have such fond memories of them. So, never have been able to so far.
Right, right. What was it like going back from this R&R? I've heard a lot of people say that it was difficult to go back. Obviously, some people look at it like, well, it's my job and it's Monday morning and I got to be back to work. How did you view that?
Well, I just knew I had to go back. I don't remember having any particular rest one way or the other. Just I got to relax some, blah blah blah, and then it was time to go back, and I don't remember doing that either. The only thing I remember is sitting there having to wait on a C-130 at Saigon to take me back up to Montague or whoever it was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember waiting for transportation.
Yeah. Now, you're there in 65 and 66, and then again you come back again 68 to 69. And in a lot of ways, and we touched on this a little bit, but in a lot of ways the war had changed. What did you see in the conduct of the war in terms of the differences from your first tour to your second tour?
Well, the biggest thing I saw was the amount of combat troops they had over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had a ton of them when I went back. The mission was all the same. You know, I didn't see anything. The conduct of the war was, you know, some of their policies, you know, in retrospect, was just borders on ludicrous, you know. But anyway, it's just a heck of a lot more NVA coming in.
Mm-hmm.
That was your biggest threat. The Kong is somewhat, they'd been decimated in the Tet Offensive. That
mm-hmm.
was not the United States did not lose that at all. They tore the Kong totally up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so they were pretty much out of the picture, but your NVA was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pouring in the country at a pretty good pace. You know, regardless of the B-52 striking the Ho Chi Minh Trail and all the rest of that stuff, they were still coming in. So there was a lot more of that. When I was in my first tour, I never saw a mortar or a rocket, and I saw that it was pretty consistent my
mm-hmm.
whole second tour, you know.
Right.
To show you one, I was in the cot, I was sleeping in the cot, and I had there was a little shelf above where I had my flight helmet, and it was up there, and a 109 rocket hit out in front of my tent, blew me out of the cot, okay, and it put, I forget how many holes through my helmet, knocked it off, and I had a fan, which was my one beautiful possession that could keep the air moving in that stupid hot tent, and that rocket took it out. And I said, if I ever catch that SOB, I will personally tear his tonsils out with my bare hands. So, anyway, that was it. I was in a bunker another time, and one hit right on the top of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, tell me about the quality of the enemy at this time. You say there was more NVA. How did they differ from the VC?
They were more disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had better weapons. I think that's what it was. They were disciplined. They had better weapons. They could be more effective. Okay, than the Kong. The Kong was sort of loose knit. You know,
mm-hmm.
and they had some training, but not enough to really make them good soldiers per se. At least my opinion.
Mm-hmm. What about the attitude of Americans in general in Vietnam? I mean, you have the war protests going on in the United States. You have all the blowback from the war and the lack of a successful conclusion to the war. Or at least the progress to the war is not what a lot of people had hoped. A lot of people questioning it. You have the drug culture that's flourishing in the United States. Some are saying that is what is beginning to infiltrate or make its way across the Pacific into Vietnam and American armed forces over there. Racial problems that are beginning to crop up. What about these kinds of things? And we'll take them separately. What about the issue of drug use in that second tour?
Yeah, it was going on. I didn't know it, but there was a couple of guys I found out afterwards that were taking their cigarettes, knocking all the tobacco out of them, and stuff it with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And they were blowing that stuff all around the AO,
mm-hmm.
you know, walking around drinking, smoking the stuff. I didn't know that. Found that out. There was a couple of guys who got busted by nickel bags through the fence from the Vietnamese. There was an LZ one time that was hit. What they figured was that one of the guys had gotten a bag of marijuana that was laced with something, LSD or something. I don't know what it was. Anyway, he got high on this stuff, went nuts, and he started shooting his fellow soldiers, you know. And when he went ape, the Kong hit that one particular area, you know,
mm-hmm.
to come through. So it was out there. It didn't have very good. How can I put it? The guys were sitting there smoking the stuff. The heroin use went up pretty good amount, I understand. And it was sort of chaotic. to some degree. So, but it was there, very much so.
Yeah. Now, what do you think? What do you attribute this rise of drug use to? What, why was it happening?
Well, it's one of those things that this is my thought. Don't know. Because when the guys would go out, they would go out for, it could be weeks or months at a clip, you know, and stay out there in the field. And they live like pigs, okay? You couldn't have on any deodorant because in the jungle, it would that smell would go through. And
mm-hmm.
you could smell, they could smell you coming, you know, and stuff along those lines. And it was just stressful because when they come back in, they'd have a little bit of downtime to turn around and go back again. And I think maybe that was part of it. The other half was trying to just eliminate reality because they didn't want to be there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I really don't know. I think that was it, in most part.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that stands to reason as well. Where did you see these guys, or where you, your understanding of it? Who were these guys? Were they rear echelon troops, or were they just, you know, soldiers from the 1st Cav who were just trying to deal with the difficulties of the war experience? Who were these guys?
Okay, which ones?
Those were using marijuana or heroin.
The heroin, it was one of those things that I'd picked up on. I don't know who it was,
mm-hmm.
okay, or where they were. I just know it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
The marijuana, the guys were blowing marijuana in the AO, and I knew those two guys. They were pilots.
Is that right?
Yeah, but the guys told me, and I this is after the fact, of course. They told me that they had never ever done that when they were up for flying.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe them.
Yeah,
I do. They were honest about it. So.
And again, that's
I give them that. They shouldn't have been doing it to start off with. But.
Sure. And that would stand to reason. Your effectiveness when you're impaired is not going to be nearly what it should be, and you're in a very, very dangerous situation, obviously.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. And another issue I brought up moments ago was the issue of race. We know that there are racial problems in Vietnam, especially in the latter parts of the war, and here you are there in 68 and 69. Did you see that become a factor at all from your experience?
No, not in my unit. And you have to remember, like I keep telling you, Kelly, my little world was so constrictive.
Mm-hmm.
On that second tour. You only see the PX once and stuff like that. So I wasn't out amongst the troops,
mm-hmm.
per se. I shot for them all the time, but I never saw them. You know, I wasn't with the rest of the division because you had to sort of sit there in your own little AO and wait for the next mission to come up. So I understood it happened, but I didn't have first-hand knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm. So morale and race relations, say, within your unit, was would you say was okay?
Oh, the morale was all right. I mean, it was nothing. It wasn't anything great.
Mm-hmm.
Little things like the first Cav said you could have 2 beers a day if you wanted it. Then they gave it to you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody could drink them because you got all the dregs that the Saigon Warriors didn't want. And so you had rusted cans and all rusted crap, and that didn't help any.
Mm-hmm.
The food, even though the mess sergeant, everybody called him Slingshot, okay, he was a good guy. He tried his best to be innovative with the food and stuff, but it's just the same old stuff that you get me all the time. And I do remember that when we were at Quan Loi, at one particular time, we had roast beef 3 times a day for about 3 months.
Hmm.
Because he couldn't get anything else.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't eat, and I wouldn't eat a roast when I got back from Vietnam. I don't think I had a roast for 30 years.
Is that right?
Yeah, I look at that and go,
Yeah, I would imagine roast beef for a lot of people would be quite a treat, but you have it every day for 3 months. That's a whole different issue.
Horrible. But Slingshot did, let me tell you about him a little bit. By trade, he was a baker, and he was also afraid of dying in his sleep.
Hmm.
And so we used to get rocketed more at night than we did anything else. So what he would do is he would stay up all night baking. And so it's almost every meal we had either these beautiful white biscuits or for lunch and dinner we had big yeast rolls, you know. And that was how he was trying to makes the food a little bit more palatable. And he used to make cinnamon buns and all the rest of that stuff.
Hmm.
So I have to give him his just due. He really tried. He was just limited by what he had. So.
Right, right. And those kinds of things can go a long way to help improve a unit's morale when you have good food or you see someone is actually trying to make things better, for sure. Yeah. But what about mail? Are you receiving mail from your folks?
Oh, yeah. Mail was good. It was coming in regularly, you know, going out regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not an issue with that stuff.
Yeah, right, right. Well, take me through the winding down period of your second tour. When you know that you're going to be leaving, and I guess this is, what, May of 1969, what is it like to see that date on the horizon? Short-timer's calendar, do you have that going? Are you concerned about the missions, the pace of missions, the amount that you're going out? Tell me about what it's like to be a short-timer in Vietnam.
I'm sorry, Kelly, I can't. Don't remember.
Hmm, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, interesting. That's really, really interesting. Usually
no,
this is...
I don't remember even coming home.
No kidding.
Mm.
Hmm.
I couldn't tell you what the airplane I was on, who was flying it, nothing.
I'll be darned. Were you aware of when you were... I would assume you were aware of when you were going home, right?
Oh, yeah. I had a zero state and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find that your missions were more frequent, less frequent? I mean, do they hold you back, say, when you've got a month left, or are you going out there every day to the end?
Like I said, I don't remember any of that stuff, but chances are that didn't get held back at all.
Hmm, yeah.
You know.
Just so much to do with the first cab, yeah. Hmm. All right, well, is there anything else about your time there in the second tour that comes to mind that you'd like to get on the record?
No, not really. It was a stressful time, much mm-hmm. more stressful than my first tour, you know. But I did learn how to fly a Cobra. I did learn how to shoot rockets with fairly good amount of accuracy,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I do feel good about supporting the infantry, you know, and helping those guys out. And hopefully, I kept some of them safe. Hopefully, I saved some lives by being there for them. So
mm-hmm.
that's the only thing I've got to say about that.
Yeah. And you mentioned that one of the reasons, maybe the reason that you went over there was because you said that maybe you can keep a married guy from having to go over, and you lost a pilot who took a mission for you at one time. And I know that was a big motivating factor for you there. So that,
yep.
It sounds like that was a very positive part of it. But what about the war in general? How do you feel about the war? A lot of people said, we knew this was a losing cause at this time, and we're not feeling good about the policies. I believe you used the word ludicrous a moment ago. What did you think about the way the war was when you were getting ready to leave? I mean, what about the second tour?
Well, when I came home from my second tour, you know, the protests were still going on, a bunch of other stuff, and I started looking around, you know. I hadn't given too much thought to the political process or how they were doing it, blah, 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 because it's none of my business. I'm just a soldier. Just get out there and do what you're told. But then I got to looking at it, you know, and a lot of the policies that they had at a particular time, like moving whole villages and stuff, that was stupid, you know. I don't think that worked at all. In fact, I know it didn't,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was also something else, too, Kelly, that I read after the thought. I didn't have it at that particular time, but I read it afterwards. You know, the chief censor was a Vietnamese. It was a woman, and she was a Hmong, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know that you're going to get, news from that's beneficial to the Hmong or those guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was when you have your news skewed so bad, people in the back are not going to be able to know the truth or anything else, because the Hmong were actually, they were sort of nasty folks. You know, it was not uncommon for them to blow up schoolhouses with all the kids in it and stuff like this. It was just total terror, you know. But anyway, when I got back, I saw all this stuff going on, and I started just questioning it about it. And I didn't go ape. I didn't have didn't participate in all the demonstrations and all the rest of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have some questions about it. That's all.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that. You come home in May of 69. You mentioned the demonstrations, and you're paying some attention to some different parts of it. But what were your thoughts on just the war itself? I mean, you said you didn't pay much attention to the political side of it, but do you give it any consideration of why are we here with these kinds of restrictions, and what is the overall goal here, and how are we trying to achieve it? Are those kinds of questions popping into your mind at all?
No, not really, because most of us at that particular time just didn't know a heck of a lot about what was going on, what were the policies and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was basically closed in-house. And then I found out all about the policies, most of that stuff, you know, after the fact. You know, and I'd go around and I'm going, well, that didn't make any sense. Why did we do that?
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of other stuff. So, I don't know if that helps or not.
Yeah, sure. Well, you get back to the States. Where do you go from there? How much time do you still have left in the Army?
I didn't. I was, when I hit, I do remember this portion. When I hit Travis, they directed me over to this one area. And so I went over there, and I was out of the Army, I think, in 30 minutes.
Hmm.
And so I was released. I put on my civilian clothes. They transported me over to San Francisco International, and I got on an airplane and flew. And over there, I was just, Hare Krishna was running around cramming flowers around the place, and I almost crammed one up his ass, you know. But I felt sorry for the young soldiers who were coming in because they were getting harassed.
Tell me about that. What did you see in this harassment?
Oh, they were just, you know, people saying, they'd call them baby killers, you know, and stuff like this. I'm just sitting off the side watching. And thankfully, they did have some USOs and other areas within the airport there that the guys could go to. And they were free of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, at that particular time. The guys were coming in. They were, like, they were going over to Travis, or they were trying to go back to their homes or some, you know. And it was the American public was just trying to eat its own.
Yeah.
That's what they were doing.
That's a really interesting way to put that. I've not heard it put that way before. Hmm.
You know, though, like I said previously, Kelly, they were sitting there and they were bad-mouthing the soldiers. And the soldiers were only doing what the government told them to do.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a problem, then you go demonstrate at the White House and you demonstrate at the Congress Hall and all the rest of that stuff. That's what you do, but you don't blame the guy for doing what the government told him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you're back.
Go ahead.
No, please.
No, I was just going to say that I think you alluded to it before. That's why so many people, the Vietnam-era people, you know, have such bad taste in their mouth. Okay? They come home, they live like a pig over there, for the most part, infantry, Marines, you know. They go there, live like a pig, do what they're told. They come home, and then people call them baby killers and spit on them. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's three-quarters of the problem with most Vietnam vets. It's like the guys now who come home, and I'm so happy to see it, you know? They people shake their hands and say thank you for your service and all the rest of the stuff, and I totally agree with that. That's what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the Vietnam vet didn't get that.
Yeah.
And so he was over there with people trying to kill him. Then he comes home and people spurn him. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, how can you win? You can't win anything on that. So.
Right. And it's interesting that you would say that. I've heard that from a number of different people, not begrudging what the soldiers today are getting and are very, very happy that it's happening and happy to participate in this and feel a comradeship with the young service members who are coming back today. But there's also this kind of latent idea of, hey, why wasn't this here for us? I'm so glad you guys are getting it. Why wasn't it here for us? Do you still think there's that bitterness still out there today even?
I don't know. Sometimes I think there is, because the bitterness for Jane Fonda still is out there big time.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so I think maybe so. It was one of those things that was just so ingrained, and it happened. It was so catastrophic and traumatic, as it were. I will pass this on to you. I was talking to a sergeant major, the 101st Airborne. We were out playing golf or something together, and he was during that time. And what he did was he was telling me that one time they had this demonstration or something, and he was on guard duty. You know, he was one of the guys, had the helmets on, had the bayonets and the rifles and all the rest of that stuff, trying to keep these guys, put some order to them or whatever. And he said, my fellow Americans came up, and he said, they spit on me so much, it was dripping off my face. And he said, nobody will ever spit on me again. Now, how do you get rid of those kind of images?
Yeah.
I would think it'd be almost impossible.
Yeah.
So, and that's what a whole bunch of these guys say, or felt, or saw, or
sure,
somebody did to them. So.
Well, you're out of the Army very, very quickly once you come back to the States at the end of your second tour. What's the next step for Archie Pitts? What do you do next?
Well, I flew into Dallas, and started, my brother and I got an apartment, and I got a job, and I was wanting to go back to school, and that was mistake number one. Me and school just do not get along. Now, my daughters, my wife, they do real well in school, but I don't.
Yeah, you mentioned you have a house full of PhDs over at your
yeah,
place.
Yeah, that's true. And but anyway, so I wanted to go back. I spent a year up in Dallas, and then I went to Southwest Texas State University down in San Marcos. Promptly flunked out. But during all that time, I had joined the Texas Guard.
Okay.
And I was flying for them down in Austin. And there was a lieutenant colonel came in. He said something about joining back up again. And I said, well, I got out to go to school. And that was a bust. So I just filled out the paperwork to go back in the Army, and they picked it up. And so after about 2 years and 9 months, I came back in the service.
Is that right?
Yes.
I wonder if you might talk about this for a moment. You're at you're flying for the Texas Guard at this time, and this is 69, 70, this kind of period, maybe 71. What was the environment like in Austin and that area regarding the war and some of the social turmoil that we're experiencing in the country at that time?
I don't remember too much, but if there was any, had been down to the University of Texas, down there.
Yeah.
Not
so much.
I know in the guard unit itself, the guys were doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a whole bunch of us were Vietnam vets. And we were sitting there flying, got to do stuff we liked to do, and blah, blah, blah. So the morale was good in the guard unit itself, and I don't really remember too much of anything going on as far as demonstration stuff, I guess, but I'm sure some of it happened down at UT.
Yeah, yeah. But not so much at Southwest Texas State when you were there?
No, there was nothing there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, very good. Now, you go back into the Army. What's the rest of your career path at that point?
Oh, I went back in January of 72. I went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky in the 101st Airborne Division. From there, I went to the advanced course, and then I went to Germany for 3 years. I was with the 3rd Infantry Division there, and then I was transferred to Alaska and went to Fairbanks at the 172nd Infantry Brigade, and I stayed there 5 years, and from there I transferred down to Fort Hood, down to Killeen, and I stayed there 5 years, and then I went to Korea on an unaccompanied tour, and I came back and went up to 101st again, and I got out after a year, so that was it.
Well, tell me about the state of the Army at this time. There are well-known problems in the Army in a variety of different ways toward the end of the Vietnam experience and then as after the Vietnam experience. What was it like to be in the Army? Did you see any substantive changes in the Army at this time, good or bad?
Well, yeah, I remember when I was at Fort Campbell, we had this EO classes like every week, you know, for race relations and stuff like that. There was not too much about drug use, but I remember it was really big into race relations. I remember that. And we had to go, like, it was an hour or 2 hour class every week for I forget how long. So.
Right. What was the content?
The Army itself, the guys were coming home. When I was at Fort Campbell, the 101st was coming home. They were completing, they were staying over in Vietnam, and they were coming home at the time. And it was one of those things that the guys were coming in. The morale was good. They were home, you know. Most of them were getting out, okay, because they were no longer required to draftees and stuff. And so it was pretty good, you know.
Yeah. So. You mentioned courses on race relations. Do you remember the content of these things? What were they saying?
Always a big thing is you know, it's just like, you know, we're all soldiers, you know, we have to respect each other, blah, 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 you know.
Right.
Standard line, you know. So, you know, and they didn't, they never used the N word, which was good.
Right.
And, but they were talking about, it's like, just anything. It was race relations, it was the Hispanics, blacks, whites, all they're just interrelated, you know. But out there in the field, most of the time, if you were in the field, you didn't, the race meant nothing.
Right. Oh, yes.
Bullets start flying, you don't see anybody on the race. You just see your fellow soldiers sitting there. You got to protect his back, he's got to protect yours.
Right.
You know. But back in garrison, there was the guys who were hardline and stuff like this. But you always have boneheads, regardless.
Of course. Of course. Now, are you paying any attention to what's going on in Vietnam after you come back?
Oh, just a little bit, because they were already starting to wound down, you know, and stuff. But I do remember watching, and it really got to me. The time when all those clips, news, when they were evacuating Saigon and the NVA were coming in with the tanks and stuff and taking over the city. And I remember those guys, people flying out aircraft and landing on aircraft carriers and stuff like this, and they were pushing the Hueys and stuff off the end of the deck, you know, and stuff to make way for more aircraft, you know, and it just, that got to me. That bothered me.
Yeah. Why?
Simple. But 2 years of my life for absolutely not a damn thing.
You still feel that way?
Sure do.
Has that affected your view of your service?
Well, I enjoyed the Army, okay, Kelly, and I don't know, I don't think so, but it was like, you know, sometimes the politicians do stuff that goes nowhere, you know.
Yeah.
It's like some of the stuff that goes on today, it makes no sense to me, you know, and I vote accordingly. But some of that stuff is, yeah, it just, it's like how many people died, 55,000 or so, I got a good friend on the wall, and for what? The domino theory? Bull. It didn't happen, you know. All the rest of that stuff. And I, other things like, supposedly, I read somewhere that JFK, his thought on Vietnam was, we support them every way we can with any kind of material, but no troops. You know? And then he gets assassinated, and we get Johnson in there, and he does everything but. You know? Next thing I know, Vietnam is increasing. Now we got the big red one over there. The first cab shows up, you know? And they put all these divisions in, combat troops, and we lost 55,000. So, for what? Nothing.
Hey, you mentioned the two presidents here, the two Democratic presidents. What about the Republican president who took over? Nixon, of course. What was your opinion on the way he was approaching the war?
Well, he approached it, the way I understand, what he did was, he made a deal with the South Vietnamese, you know, that he was going to support, he would support them, like, with anything. Okay, and that's part of the peace accords that Kissinger came up with, is that if they lost a tank, he'd replace it with a tank. If they shot a bullet, he'd replace the bullet. Okay, things along those lines. One-for-one replacement of the current inventory of what they had. After he, after the accords were signed and the combat troops are withdrawn, then the Democratic Congress cut off funding.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't do it anymore. You know?
Yeah.
So, I thought he did a pretty good job, I think, because they were still part of, CETO was still there, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. And so, the United States was signatory to that, so it was our duty to help those other folks if they got in a bind, which doesn't bother me as far as material goes.
Yeah.
You know, but I just don't think it was worth, worth 55,000 lives plus a whole bunch more people who are mentally disturbed from it or hurt mentally, also wounded, and I just don't think it was worth it.
Yeah.
So I think, to answer your question about Nixon, I think he did pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a number of times that this second tour was so much more intense and stressful than the first tour. You come back to a stateside environment, and you know, whether it's anti-war protests or whatever, but what about you personally? Did you find it was difficult to adjust to civilian life afterward?
What, the first tour? Second tour?
After the second tour.
No. No. Mm-hmm. The only thing I will say, well, I guess I did to some degree, there was a siren went by, and I wound up on the floor one night because the siren would blaze, would take off when you had incoming coming in. So.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. So there was I was driving through Dallas in a jackhammer. I didn't notice he was over there. And he started off, and that sounds pretty much like a machine gun. And I think I swapped two lanes, you know. That wasn't good. Thankfully, nobody was over there. So, but after that, those two things, not too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, I've got just a couple of questions more for you, Mr. Pitts, and I generally ask these questions of all the veterans who I interview, and a pretty broad question. So feel free to interpret and answer them as you see fit. But as you look back on your two tours experience in Vietnam and living through that era, how do you think these experiences most affected your life?
I think the biggest thing that happened was that, like I told you previously, I went over as a young man and I came back older, you know.
Hmm.
I do believe that I did lose whatever it was that I had. It stayed over there. I think that was the biggest impact it had. I got a lot of experience flying while I was there, which was good for me later on. But I think those are the two of the big things. I don't think it affected me like thought processes and stuff along those lines too much, but it did affect, I just guess I grew up a lot.
Yeah. Now, at the end of your first tour, you said that you were speaking with your mother and she wanted to know what had happened to the old Archie Pitts, her old son.
Yeah.
Did you find anything like that? Did your parents or family react in any way after this tour?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, the last question I have for you, and again, it's a pretty broad one, but as we look back on everything that was the Vietnam War, you know, we're always trying to figure out what is the legacy of the war. The war means this. No, the war means this. Let me ask someone who was there for two tours at two very different times, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What does it mean?
Well, Vietnam was, how can I put it? It was a learning field, per se, and I don't think we learned anything from it. I think that's the legacy. You had people go out on faulty political policies, and we're still doing it today, so I think Vietnam was one of those learning things that we should learn how to deal with our enemies and our friends much better than what we do. You know, I think that's the legacy of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's also one of those things that's extremely sad because we lost so many people for no reason. I think that was another one. Some of Vietnam comes out like one of those sad but true stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real tearjerker.
Yeah. You mentioned the wall in the past. Have you visited the Vietnam Memorial?
Oh, yeah. Been there several times.
In Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
What kind of effect does that have on you?
None.
Hmm.
I go in, there's a good friend of mine on the wall there. And, well, I say none. That's a lie. I go in and I just look at those names, put my hand across the wall, and feel the etchings and stuff. And I get somewhat sad, you know, because all those young men who died over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's more, that memorial's more poignant than you looking at some soldier standing or something like this with a rifle, because you look at a black slab that has souls written on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's more moving to see that, and it's more real. Because now you see names, you know.
Yeah.
In the Korean World War II, you don't see anything like that. So.
Yeah, it's obviously incredibly powerful.
Yeah. So.
Well, Mr. Pitts, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
No, not at all. Your questions were very to the point. I can't think of anything else to put out.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and bring a close to this interview then. Thank you very much.